Support for Boston Public Radio comes from the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Be revolutionary. UMass is the Commonwealth's flagship public research university and committed to the relentless pursuit of progress. Learn more at umass.edu.
And Eastern Bank, committed to helping people and businesses prosper by investing over $240 million in local charities since 1994. Eastern Bank. Join us for good. EasternBank.com. Member FDIC.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, President Trump's WMD, wall of mass distraction, starting to crumble with his Russia problems returning to the spotlight. And as the government shutdown grinds on, can we really believe there's a national emergency if Trump is so hesitant to declare one? We take on these and other headlines on today's politics roundup. From there, we talk to Charlie Sennett about how anti-immigration sentiment is creating transatlantic paralysis. In the U.S., we have our border wall breakdown, and in the U.K., they have a battle over Brexit.
At noon, we open the lines and ask you about the FBI investigating President Trump and speculation that the president could be a Russian asset. Do this work to the Democrats' 2020 advantage, or do they run the risk of alienating Trump's base by intensifying the so-called witch hunt? Then TV Bob Thompson is here to talk about The Sopranos 20 years later and how the show transformed television. That's next on Boston Public Radio. Rowdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello, Jim.
Hello, Marjorie. So we are 24 days into a government shutdown. It's the all-time record, as you probably know. And for Trump, that has meant 3 weeks of news coverage that is focused on little else. But it turns out the fight over the border wall isn't the best firewall when it comes to keeping the president's Russian problems out of the spotlight. On Thursday, Michael Cohen said he's agreed to testify before Congress in early February. And on Friday, as you know, the New York Times broke a story about an FBI inquiry into whether Trump had secretly worked on behalf of Russia. Joining us to talk about these and other political headlines are Jennifer Beceris and Steve Kerrigan. Jennifer is a political columnist, senior fellow with the Independent Women's Forum, and a former commissioner of the United States Commission on Civil Rights. Hello, Jennifer.
Good morning.
And Steve is a president and co-founder of the Massachusetts Military Heroes Fund, former CEO of the Democratic National Convention. Steve, nice to see you.
Nice to see you both.
So let's start with something that I think is pretty surprising. I mean, sometimes I feel like we're like frogs in the water. You know, you get put in the water and then the water gets heated up and heated up and heated up before you know you're like boiled to death. I think the president may be the frog, not you. Well, could be. But I feel like sometimes we Americans are, because there's been so many weird things that the Trump administration has done. But I got to say, I stood up and paid attention over the weekend when the New York Times reported that essentially the FBI was investigating the sitting president of the United States for treason, for being a Russian agent, or best case scenario, maybe not knowing he was a Russian agent. What'd you make of this?
I think the FBI is out of control when I read that. I'm dumbfounded. I mean, the only reason they put forward for doing so was the firing of James Comey, which we all knew about. The notion that he's a Russian agent or, quote unquote, working for the Russians because of this personnel decision is absurd. I mean, there was more reason to doubt whether or not President Obama had the best interests of the country in mind when he told, you know, the Russian president that he would have more flexibility after the election than there was to investigate Donald Trump. I think it's absurd. There's so many things that one could investigate Donald Trump for. I think that is a politicization of electoral politics, and it's just beyond the pale.
Let's play, before you respond, let's play this interview he had with Fox News' Jeanine Pirro on Saturday. This morning he said he was not working with the Russians, but he didn't say this when he was talking to her about whether or not he was a Russian agent on Saturday night. Here it is.
Have you ever worked for Russia, Mr. President?
I think it's the most insulting thing I've ever been asked. I think it's the most insulting article I've ever had written. And if you read the article, you'd see that they found absolutely nothing. But the headline of that article, it's called The Failing New York Times for a Reason. They've gotten me wrong for 3 years. They've actually gotten me wrong for many years before that.
What do you make of this, Steve Kerrigan? I had a different reaction than Jennifer.
I'll agree with one part of Jennifer's comments, that it is absurd. The whole thing is absurd. The fact that Donald Trump is our president is absurd, but we are where we are. It is not based solely on his Comey comments. Although, first, saying it directly to Lester Holt that the reason why he fired him was the Russia investigation was a problem and is concerning.
But it's also make it's him all, a no, Russian
I,
agent.
I let you hold on. His family and campaign staff met with representatives of the Russian government and Russian attorneys in the summer. He stood on a stage at a time that we later realized was a time when they were hacking the DNC and said maybe they could hack and find those 33,000 emails. The FBI followed the trail of potential evidence, and they came at least publicly right now to the conclusion that there's nothing. But what the president said, what the president said on Jeanine, on Fox News rather, was not entirely true. The article doesn't conclude that there's nothing. It just concludes that there's nothing in the public right now. Mm-hmm. And as we all know, the Mueller investigation is going to continue for a long time, and the FBI is a critical part of this. I just think it is astounding that, like Marjorie, all weekend long I kept drilling into this story because I found it astounding that over and over and over again people were saying on TV the president of the United States was being investigated by the FBI for treasonous activities. And honestly, not that many people blinked an eye.
Well, Jennifer,
many people believe it.
Well, I think a lot of people think that the president's problems with Russia have to do with money and have to do with the fact that he's been bolstered up by Russia. Max Boot, who's a Republican, as you know, but is not a fan of the president, talked about in this piece he wrote for the Washington Post, 18 Reasons Trump Could Be a Russian Asset. He talked about the fact that from 2003 to 2017, Russians made these all-cash purchases, a red flag for money laundering of properties, total a lot of money, $109 million. Deutsche Bank loaned him millions of dollars, that is Trump, during the same time was laundering billions in Russian money. His kids talked about how the Russians bailed them out over again, then they had to go to American banks. That and the fact of his meeting with Kislyak and saying how great it was, you get rid of this pressure from Comey. That, when he goes on television and says that he's got rid of Comey because of Russia, all these things kind of go together.
I think the problem politically for critics of the president is instead of discussing the specific instances that Max Boot brings up and investigating those specific instances, by saying that he's a Russian agent or somehow working for the Russian government against the interest of his country, so politicizes it that his supporters dig in, and it's not helping the cause of those who wish to see the president brought to task for things he may have done that are unethical.
Well, you know, I've stayed out of this so far, but it doesn't, to me, it doesn't matter at this day, because we will wait for what Mueller has to say, whether Steve's analysis or Jennifer's is right. I think what I am speechless about is the FBI, even if you believe it became a renegade agency, the FBI chose to investigate whether the president of the United States of America was working wittingly or unwittingly for the Russian government. And then he's got to answer a question, not got to, does.
But just because
he's addressed by the sycophantic Fox News interviewer about whether or not you're a Russian agent. I mean, that's a pretty dramatic moment. Even if it turns out the FBI and Mueller conclude the answer is no, the fact that they thought a threshold was crossed, Jennifer, where an investigation was appropriate, is mind-boggling to me.
The FBI also investigated Martin Luther King for alleged ties to communists. I mean, there are lots of times when the FBI opens investigations into people in this country. Civil libertarians will tell you that it's been either inappropriate or unfounded. The fact of an investigation just means that there doesn't, and I'm not casting dispersions on the entire agency, it just means there are certain people in the agency who think something's worth looking into.
But, you know,
that
but
doesn't make
but
it.
Except for you just said we politicized the whole thing, except for you, your exact words were just to say that someone in the agency thought that it was something worth looking into. I would gather, based on all this evidence,
that was also under J. Edgar Hoover, who had a lot of ethical problems in a lot of areas. I'm not sure anybody's accused James Comey or his successor as having huge ethical...
There were a lot of people in the FBI who were severely biased against the president. And look, I didn't vote for the president. I'm
Can I be clear here?
President,
let me just finish my thought for a second. If this was in isolation, putting aside Max Boot for a moment, if this were in isolation, I would probably agree with you. But we could spend the next 3 hours talking about circumstantial evidence that suggests that Donald Trump's behavior vis-a-vis Vladimir
Helsinki,
Putin and the Russians is rather
the change in the platform.
To say
one could argue
the least.
That he's taken a stronger foreign policy stance against Russia than the Obama
administration does,
that ceded Crimea, that ceded the Ukraine that allowed a power vacuum in the Middle East and allowed Putin to come into Syria and make a mess of that. One could argue that Barack Obama colluded with Vladimir Putin.
No one could argue that other than maybe Donald Trump and you. And that I would caution you against doing that because I like
you
a lot.
Steve, pick up the National Review. Pick up any intellectual conservative publication and you will find there are serious people in this country who think that Obama
I totally understand that, but this is not this is the go-to for every Donald Trump supporter is the whataboutisms. Rather than discussing
Donald Trump,
you're certainly carrying some water this morning anyway.
I just think the New York Times article
was crazy. Let him finish, Jennifer, and then you can respond. I'm sorry. Go ahead,
rather than addressing the questions that have been raised about Donald Trump, clear connections to Russia, whether you agree with the policy or not, clear confusion, if not collusion, with Putin. Another story this weekend in the Washington Post where he took the notes from the translator of the Helsinki meeting. We have no one in Congress or no one in his administration knows anything about several conversations that he has had with the leader of Russia.
Nobody
that
is has a right to.
But to form a functioning government to represent the people of the United States, it would be nice to know what is happening between us and our chief adversary. And so I'm just saying that, I think, is something that's worth looking into. And going back to, what happened to Martin Luther King or what happened to Barack Obama, I think is frankly a waste of our time.
Look, all I know is it must drive Mitt Romney absolutely crazy. I mean, he was absolutely mocked by the president of the United States, Barack Obama, and by the Democratic Party for saying that Putin and Russia were the biggest threat to this country. They laughed. They said the 1980s called. They want their foreign policy back. Yeah. And you know what? Mitt Romney was right.
Great. We're still not talking about Mitt Romney. We're talking about Donald Trump being investigated by the FBI for, frankly, I think, circumstances and situations that, frankly, warrant it.
There may be situations that warrant concern. He is not an agent of the Russian government.
We'll let the FBI decide.
You don't know.
Highly unlikely.
We're talking to Jennifer Becerra.
Unwitting
Steve
agent
Kerrigan.
Would be more what I would.
He's definitely
would
unwitting.
Find likely because it's very odd the way he's acted.
So we're in day 24 of the shutdown. Everybody knows it's the longest shutdown in American history. What's the end game here, Steve Kerrigan? Lindsey Graham suggested that essentially everybody go back to work for 3 weeks, and if at the end of 3 weeks it was not a negotiated deal, then you can declare a national emergency and go find the money, President Trump, to build the wall yourself. The president, I think somewhat respectfully this morning, rejected that suggestion. We all know there were no paychecks on Friday. What is the end game here?
Yeah, I mean, I think Lindsey Graham threw the president a lifeboat, and I don't, you know,
I thought so
the
too.
The same way he does, same way he does it all the time. He doesn't see it as that, and because it wasn't his idea, and so he rejects it. I mean, the majority of Americans believe that President Trump and Republicans in Congress are responsible for the shutdown. But to me, this isn't about. I worked through the last longest government shutdown in the 90s, and to me, this isn't about who's responsible. It's about leadership. And what you saw last week was the president give his first Oval Office address and said absolutely nothing new and followed up with absolutely nothing new. He went to the border and to do an act that he actually said to reporters off the record was nothing more than a photo op and would change nothing. And at the same time, oh, by the way, at taxpayer expense, he went to the border. And at the same time, the Democrats in the House of Representatives were passing bills and sending them to the Senate to do exactly what Lindsey suggested, which was to reopen the government and decide the Homeland Security and border security stuff later. And instead of taking those bills up and passing them in the Senate, Mitch McConnell objected to their even consideration because they want to make sure that the president gets his wall funding. And I frankly think those demonstrating leadership are those Democrats in the House and those in the Senate. And frankly, by the way, also Lisa Murkowski from Alaska, who stood on the Senate floor and said we need to reopen the government. And now, I hate to say this, but now Lindsey Graham is demonstrating.
Jennifer,
leadership.
The thing I don't understand, we discussed with this discussion about the emergency and it was the best way out for the president. We discussed, I think, first with Chuck Todd last week from Meet the Press. I don't understand at all why he's rejected this, because trying to put myself in the place of Donald Trump, it's sort of the perfect opportunity for him to claim victory on 42 accounts. One, I have put the federal workers, 800,000 of them, back to work. The Democrats don't care about them. I did, and I can't see them not earn money anymore. Put the facts aside for a second. Two, you will get the wall that you want, even though people don't want it. You will get the wall you want by me taking unilateral action because the Congress is so irresponsible. So the only possible argument I can think of which would cause him not to do that, either a la Lindsey Graham or today, is that conservative Republicans don't like the whole concept of presidents grabbing that much power and taking unilateral action, and it may upset them. Is that the reason for the hesitancy?
I think that may be it. I think that the constitutional
and the precedent that it would
conservatives
set, yeah.
around him do not like that precedent. They didn't like it when Obama took unilateral action on certain
right.
issues, and they want to be consistent. That may be what he ends up doing, but frankly, I don't think he cares either way, as long as he gets his way. Right, that's all he cares about, and this is red meat for his base. They love him. They support him. They are it's firing them up, and he sees it as win-win politically.
What do you think is the end game here? I mean, this is going to end at some point, one must assume. What? How does it end?
I don't know. I mean, I do think, look at, you know, politics is the art of compromise, and Democrats don't want a wall. I understand that. But they do want, and many Republicans want, DACA. And it seems to me an easy deal, the wall for DACA. And, you know, even Alexander Hamilton had to agree to move the capital to the South to get his national bank. I mean, this is what happens in politics.
But you know what I wonder, though, is that the president has been close to other deals before, and then he's gotten this blowback. If the story
well, it was
should
Miller
read,
and Sessions who stopped it the first
Ann
time.
Coulter and Rush Limbaugh don't want the DACA.
Yeah,
the DACA deal. So isn't that the problem? Because that does seem like it would be a
maybe, but
solution.
I think if I were czar of the universe, that would be the deal, the wall for DACA.
Well, was the deal once.
At one point,
but that would be the end game. The solution.
I will ask you as a Democrat. You're the fifth straight Democrat I've had on the show where I will ask same question. How do Pelosi and Schumer, I did. How do Pelosi and Schumer, and I'm amazed that Trump has not put them in this box, but maybe because he doesn't want to get tied to the DACA deal, since they were willing to give him five times as much money for the wall once, just exactly a year ago, in return for the deal on Dreamers, how can they not propose the exact same deal if they're so concerned about 800,000 workers out of a job and a million Dreamers who are at risk? Why not just propose? And by the way, they'd only end up spending one-fifth as much money on the wall. It seems to be.
And that may be where we end up, because if you're waiting to use that final card, you're waiting until the very end. And I sadly don't think we're there. If they agreed on a number, like the Democrats said, had already passed some border security funding, I think $1.6 or $2
million. But they agreed to $25 billion a year ago.
And then he didn't take it.
I understand that, but they proposed it.
Right, but my
and
point
if they
is,
proposed it, how can they say $5 billion is too much when $25 billion in return for protection for Dreamers was acceptable?
Because the $5 billion, the $25 billion was part of not a continuing resolution to restart the government. This was a larger discussion. And that's, by the way, what border security deserves, because Democrats do support border security. It just shouldn't be part of a larger discussion. And
it
I'll say this.
It should be, but it can be piecemeal too.
It can be, which is what they were trying to do. And they tried to do it last year in another continuing resolution where they gave him a couple of billion dollars, where they have now only spent 6% of the billions of dollars he got last year for border security. So if he's that sure this is an emergency or is that critical to get more funding for border security, maybe spend the billions he got last year. I really think this has to be part of, and I think the Democrats are saying this, has to be part of a larger discussion on border security and immigration. And frankly, this should be part of a larger discussion.
Nancy Pelosi is saying walls are immoral. They're not saying the wall is one piece of border security. They're saying the wall should be no piece of border security.
No, they're not saying that, because there are parts of border security that have
Nancy
walls.
Pelosi
they're
says.
Just saying a wall, water to water, makes absolutely no sense.
So what does it mean? You say we're not near the end. Does that mean these 800,000 people continue to be unpaid for another week or 2 weeks?
I don't see any end in sight right now, unless they do what Lindsey Graham suggested.
But there's also the theory that if people continue to blame, it may change. Trump and Republicans more than Democrats. That some Republicans will join Cory Gardner and Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski and say, let's reopen the government and then we'll decide the Homeland Security thing. I guess some of them are afraid of a challenge.
I think it's going to depend on how many government workers they have in their district.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's
the real reality of it. It's not about principle so much as it's about how matter their voters.
I mean, Mitch McConnell has been very quiet, almost mute about the entire
thing. So what do you read into that?
I read into this that he is worried about what Marjorie suggested, that there are a bunch of folks there that are watching this, analyzing it based on what Jennifer suggested and other things, and that if this goes too far, he may just let his members off the hook and let them pass some
Nancy
bill that comes
Pelosi
over from the House.
Even if Nancy Pelosi thinks a wall is immoral, it is immoral to not pay these people. When you hear the interviews with these people and the small businesses in a lot of the communities that are federal employee intensive, it is otherworldly.
No, I have a lot of friends
that
are
not getting paid. It's just it's amazing. You know, speaking of the president, and which we have been, which is all we do actually. Now that I think about it, this tweet. Here's a tweet which I'm sure you've seen. We all talked about the Elizabeth Warren. Let me get me a beer thing, which most of us thought was ill-advised. It's an Instagram thing she did today, right after she did her announcement out there in Cambridge. If Elizabeth Warren, this is a tweet from the president, often referred to me by me as Pocahontas, did this commercial from Bighorn or Wounded Knee instead of her kitchen with her husband dressed in full Indian garb, it would have been a smash. You know, beyond how disgusting it is, I'm assuming, and I'll give the president the benefit of the doubt, he has absolutely no idea what happened at Bighorn and no idea what happened at Wounded Knee, or he probably would have picked. You're laughing because you agree that he knows nothing. He has no idea what he's talking about.
Yes,
I hope he has no idea.
And because it's just funny that the president of the United States would even say that, and his base is laughing. That's what they like. I mean, the whole thing is absurd.
She was I've often said, you said she was the best teachers you had, even though you don't agree with their politics when you were at Harvard Law School. I mean, is this not gratuitous and disgusting? I mean, even if his base is laughing and loving it, and God, we love these Pocahontas jokes, nothing like a good joke about Native Americans, by the way, to make the base laugh.
Well, it's a joke about
this
her.
This is almost the behavior of a mentally ill human being. It is unbelievable.
It's the behavior
to
of a fourth grade boy. It's the behavior of my son. I hate to say it. I mean, the stupid jokes he makes with his friends, and
he could be
not
president.
About Native
Yeah, I was
going to
say, can we replace the president with your son?
But don't you think, I hate to say this, this is going to sound incredibly elitist, so here goes. Don't you think the American public often has the sense of humor of a fourth grade boy and has the, right? I mean, so this is the quote-unquote political magic of Donald Trump, is that he's captured this.
But I think he's captured it with a smaller and smaller number of people.
I don't know. I mean, they're not your audience. They're not listening to us right now.
If you look at our email, they are. And I assume we'll have emails in a few minutes.
We annoy them terribly.
You're right. Maybe that language matches up with some of what his base believes. But shouldn't we aspire for greater things from the leader of the free world and the president of the United States? And I think we all agree we should. We shouldn't expect or accept language of a four-year-old boy to be used by the president of the United States. By the way, on Twitter, which has been determined to be official statements from the office of the president of the United States. I mean,
that
tweet goes on the same thing as
the
second inaugural of Lincoln. I mean, it's the same category of
presidential
stuff.
You have no argument with me on the dignity issue and the character.
It's just embarrassing.
None whatsoever. And, you know, Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush and all the other Republicans who stood up and argued about that during the campaign feel the same way. But the fact is, the genie has been let out of the bottle. And the reason the genie's out of the bottle, I say this all the time, is because for years and years, we heard Mitt Romney's a sexist, Paul Ryan wants to throw Granny off the cliff, George Bush is a racist, and none of it was true. So people just stopped caring, and they just decided, you know what, we want a disruptor. We want somebody who's going to tell these people who think everybody's a racist and a sexist where to go. And this is what we got.
So are you suggesting Donald Trump's Twitter patterns are the fault of the Democrats and campaigns of the past?
I'm saying his election was a direct result of it, yes.
One last thing before we take a break, and then we'll continue the discussion with you two. I guess I know the answer to this, but the leader of the Republicans in the House has now said he's going to go talk to Steve King, who I think most people agree is a racist, following his most overtly racist comments about white nationalism, white supremacy, why are they offensive, to the New York Times. But the reason why they don't confront what I at least consider to be racist comments by the president are because they're scared to death of him and they're not scared of Steve King. Is that what the difference is? I mean, I commend McCarthy and the others for finally confronting King and saying you can't be part, whatever he's about to say, you can't be part of this party if you're going to behave like this.
Correct.
The reason they don't say the same things even in private to Donald Trump is because they're scared to death of his Twitter account?
Perhaps, but I also think Donald Trump has not been as explicit as Steve.
Well,
I mean,
he said, "I am a nationalist." I mean,
but
he said,
that's
in essence, similar.
Than saying a white
I understand,
it
but he was
different.
It was a dog whistle to a lot of those Steve King Republicans.
Right. I mean, there are lots of things they should have confronted him about, not speaking out about Charlottesville. There are a lot of.
Oh no, he spoke out. He just said there were nice people on both sides.
Whatever.
People
not
on both
saying. Sides. The point is, there are lots of things that he should have been confronted on, but none of them are explicitly racist. They may be dog whistles in effect, but you know, I think there's a debate about whether Donald Trump is himself a racist or whether he's just racial and plays to racial fears. I think that's a legitimate debate.
Okay, we're talking about political headlines, national political headlines from the White House, not so much the State House today, with Jennifer Beceras and Steve Carrick, and we're going to stay talking to them again about national politics when we return on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, we're talking politics with political columnist Jennifer Beceras and former head of the Democratic National Convention. That would be Steve Kerrigan.
So Elizabeth Warren visited Iowa, got pretty large crowds. Now she went to New Hampshire, done well up there. She's one of the first in the – well, maybe she is the first. She's the first in the ring, I guess.
She's not technically in the ring. She's an exploratory.
She's
committee.
Exploratory. Okay, she's not. What do you make of her candidacy?
Well, I think she's certainly got a voice that needs to be voiced in this debate, and we're going to have probably 30 people running or 20 people running, and it's not that long from the New Hampshire primary, so I'm glad to see that she got good crowds in Iowa and New Hampshire. People are clearly, based on her reception in New Hampshire at least, are hungry for the progressive voice that she's going to bring this debate, but there are a lot more people to come into the race, and I'll say this. We saw this about Bernie Sanders 4 years ago, and we'll see this about her and maybe Bernie Sanders. When you have a regional candidate like a Bay Stater running in a New Hampshire primary, it significantly dilutes the importance of New Hampshire in the primary process because a neighbor, you know, a neighbor state is more likely to win. So I wouldn't read too much into her support there, but I think it's going to be interesting. Bernie Sanders definitely has to feel the heat of are you going to get in this or not, because she's already picked up a lot of his activists and workers in Iowa to work on her campaign. So I think she's off to a good start, and we'll see how it goes.
Well, you know, unlike Hillary Clinton, who I don't think ever had a clear message about why she should be president, this is Elizabeth Warren's income inequality, 1%, 99%, system is rigged, et cetera, is kind of her whole reason for being. So she's got a clear message, a la Bernie Sanders, whether you like it or not.
She does have a clear message, which puts her at an advantage compared to Hillary Clinton. But I think she, I think if the Democrats want to lose, they will nominate Elizabeth Warren. I think Trump will beat her. I think if they're serious about beating Donald Trump in 2020, they should look to someone like Joe Biden, who can win those states that Donald Trump took out of the blue column and moved into the red, and they're going to have to go to the center.
But, you know, one of the interesting phenomenons I've been reading about, and maybe it won't work in West Virginia, or maybe it will, I don't know, is that a lot of Americans, particularly Democrats, are moving much more to the left. Supposedly Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is pushing people, and that when you look at polls, people do want better health care. People do think that the rich got away with murder in this latest tax deal. You know, people are upset about climate change. So that they're adopting more of these liberal positions.
So candidates like Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, you know, Ocasio-Cortez, politicians like them will inevitably push a more centrist candidate like Joe Biden to the left. And that may be a good thing if you're a liberal and a Democrat. But the point of a national election is you have to have an ability to win. And regardless of where you stand on the issues, a lot of it comes down to personality and connectability with the voters, which Joe Biden can do and Elizabeth Warren cannot.
So I would just say I agree with you, Marjorie, about some of the issues on the left. But I think the issues on the left are becoming more moderate and centrist and mainstream. I mean, back in the day when Roe v. Wade was decided 50 years ago, we didn't have a clear majority. We now have almost 80% of Americans support it. Gay marriage has across the board support. Climate control is recognized by most Americans. So all and
universal health care, Medicare for all.
You mentioned West Virginia. That was a huge issue for Joe Manchin, who, even though he voted for Brett Kavanaugh, that was a big issue because 800,000 people in his district could, or in his state, could have lost their health care if the ACA went away. So I think
that
those,
all may be true,
those issues are moving more to the mainstream because they're affecting people's lives.
But if you're going to pick your most divisive firebrands, then you're going to lose a national election. That is the bottom line. And so if you
Trump is probably a divisive firebrand.
I was going to say, here's hoping.
Right? That is true. Trump was, but Trump is not a hardcore conservative. He's divisive, but he did have that ability to connect with the voters. He's divisive in a different way. His views, in many ways, are much left, much more centrist than Marco Rubio or Jeb Bush or George Bush on many issues.
You know, staying on the Democrats, though, for a second, the only person who has almost as many things written about her as Donald Trump has written about him is the 29-year-old congresswoman from the Bronx. And there was a story either in the Times or the Washington or the Washington Post in the last 24 hours about how she is setting the agenda for the candidates, not only her party, but the candidates running for president. Do you support the Green New Deal? Do you support a 70% top marginal tax rate? We've talked about this a lot in the last week. Does that help the Democratic Party or does that hurt the Democratic Party? Because I assume the Warrens and the Sanders will buy in big time. The some of the other candidates will compliment her, but will try to move away from she's proposing.
I guess I take exception with the fact that she's pushing them on these issues. I think the issues are pushing them, and she's smart. She won a primary early, so she had the entire remainder of the general election to be the voice for these progressive issues while other candidates were out there fighting. Those issues were out there. People were pushing.
No Democrat running for president would be asked if they think there should be a marginal rate of 70% had it not been for her on 60 Minutes 8 days ago.
Agree with you. And
that's a pretty electric issue, by the way, particularly in the states that Jennifer's talking
about. It is, and my guess is most of them will probably say, no, it shouldn't be. But this, she's giving voice to a lot of the issues because she has the ability to from the perch that she sits on. I'm excited to have her in Congress. I hope that she gets to work with her colleagues there and doesn't focus on the voice. She's going to have a powerful voice in 2020, whether you like it or not. But I hope she actually does the work day to day, every day for the people that elected her.
We're talking to Jennifer Becerris and Steve Kerrigan. Before you guys go, there's much anticipation being built for this February 7th appearance before Congress of Mr. Cohen, the president's former fixer. And people immediately after it was announced last week were likening it to John Dean's appearance before. I loved on CNN was at a split screen the other night and John Dean's talking about whether or not Cohen's appearance is like Dean's appearance before Congress many years, obviously, during Watergate. Isn't it possible that he's not going to be able to say either because Mueller and the Southern District of New York prosecutors don't want him to say things, that this may not be nearly as electric as we are anticipating it to be, Jennifer Becerris?
Well, he says he wants to clear his conscience, whatever that means.
But if a prosecutor says, I don't want him to discuss X, Y, and Z, then Congress is not going to hear on investigations that are continuing. Congress is not going to hear from him on X, Y, and Z.
As I understand it, the testimony is not going to focus on things having to do with Russia and the Mueller probe. It's going to focus on the personal corruption issues and things to do with the Trump Organization, things to do with Stormy Daniels and the payments, and things that some people might not regard as interesting, but actually I think is where the real meat is.
Well, how about if not executive privilege or not prosecutorial discretion about you not – how about attorney-client privilege being an issue for him if the president says these were confidential conversations? Is Congress going to ask him the questions while that's being debated?
That's a
pretty tough one.
I mean, I'm not a lawyer, you guys are, but if he's aiding his client in a commission of a crime, doesn't that void all privilege?
Yeah, but does a Democrat on the committee decide to answer a question when he says, or his lawyer, whoever Cohen shows up with? All I'm saying is explosive.
Good question. Yeah. I haven't practiced law in decades, so I'm probably the wrong person.
Well, nor have I. So I'm the right person to ask, but not the right person to answer. So, but it seems to me that with all the buildup, I guess as we approach February 7th,
I tend to agree. I don't think we're going to learn very much.
He's got one hell of a New York accent, I'll say that.
I think we're going to learn a lot, just not about the larger political issues. We're going to learn a lot about the Trump organization and the ethics of that organization.
Yeah, that's probably true.
And the members will probably learn more in private briefings.
More credible concerns.
Okay, you guys, thank you very much for coming in. Jennifer Passeris is a political columnist, senior fellow with the Independent Women's Forum and a former commissioner of the United States Commission on Civil Rights. Steve Kerrigan is president and co-founder of the Massachusetts Military Heroes Fund and former CEO of the Democratic National Committee. Jennifer and Steve, thank you so much. Coming up, the Labour Party is set to call a vote to topple Theresa May's government in Great Britain. Charlie Sennett joins us for that and other international headlines next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. When President Trump meets with Vladimir Putin, do things get lost in translation deliberately? The Washington Post is reporting that Trump has gone to extreme lengths to conceal his conversations with Putin, even going so far on one occasion as to confiscate his interpreter's notes so that his own aides and cabinet members wouldn't know what the two discussed. Join us on the line for his take on this, tomorrow's Brexit vote, and what that fight in the UK over leaving the EU has in common with our fight over the border walls, Charlie Sennett. Charlie's a news analyst here at GBH. He also heads up the Ground Truth Project. Hey there, Charlie.
Hey, Jim. Hey, Marjorie.
Hey, Charlie. Great to talk to you. Great to talk to you. Well, Charlie, let's start with this, what I think is rather unusual. Trump's efforts over in Helsinki after talking with Vladimir Putin for about 2 hours with only interpreter's presence in the room. He does something unusual with the interpreter. What happened?
Well, the interpreters consistently asked to sort of turn over their notes. Taking possession of the notes is what we found out from Greg Miller's piece in the Washington Post. This is not normal to take and say, I'm going to take possession of the notes and instruct the linguist not to discuss what transpired with other administration officials. That's not normal. That is extraordinary. And the big question right now, I don't see any clear answer coming out about this, is whether or not Congress would subpoena those notes and subpoena the actual interpreter to come forward. So we're headed for a reckoning around these extraordinary things that Trump has done, and they're real fair questions. This has never happened before. We've never had a president of the United States in a situation where Russia, what do we know? We know Russia tried and intervened in our election, and we know they did so to help elect Trump. We know there have been a series of indictments and guilty pleas around relationships between Russia and people in Trump's team, both the campaign and inside of his administration. And at what point do you just say we have to stop scratching our heads and start pounding the fist and say we want to know what happened? For a long time, it's been perplexing. Now it's becoming quite worrisome, and I think it's really coming to a head now. I think this piece by Greg Miller on the weekend was pretty extraordinary.
By the way, the Senate answer to your question, Charlie, about what Congress is going to do, I think I heard that Lindsey Graham said over the weekend that he scoffed at the notion that his committee would subpoena the interpreter to testify. So I guess it's left to the Democrats to say whether or not they will call that person and whether he or she, is it a man or woman? I don't know who the interpreter was.
I don't know.
Whether he or she will show before that House committee. So,
yeah, and I guess the House can subpoena though, right?
I would assume so.
Committee could do so. Yeah. So to be determined.
So let's talk about Pompeo, the Secretary of State's visit to Syria, doing a little work about the announcement from the president to pull troops out of Syria. Now the Secretary of State is calling this a tactical change.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to just listen to Pompeo defend the president and say any of these allegations of any sort of, you know, suggestion that he would somehow be helping Russia on the world stage is outrageous. And then to listen to him and his descriptions and his contortions in Syria around what the president announced in a pullout and then him having to a great unexpected announcement, which came, as everybody remembers, last month when President Trump said the U.S. would take its troops out and that that prompted this great fear that there would be this vacuum that could really strengthen ISIS and then seed influence in the region to Iran and Russia. So the context of this does directly involve Russia and what kind of role it could play in filling a vacuum if U.S. troops pull out. Pompeo now talking about this as a tactical change rather than a troop redeployment. You know, this is language that he's trying to cover up for a pretty reckless announcement by the President of the United States. And it's pretty hard to watch our Secretary of State go through all of these contortions to keep it all together.
Yeah, I don't even understand, like, you know, the comment that Marjorie just referenced, which I guess he made in Abu Dhabi about the Syria thing. I don't even understand where it stands. I thought what happened is the president tweeted our withdrawal, which apparently virtually none of his top advisors were aware of. And then was it not Pompeo who said, don't worry, it's not happening so quickly? And now he appears to be saying it is happening, but don't worry because it's a tactical move. And I guess this morning the president said that if Turkey tries messing with the Kurds, there'll be, quote, devastating economic consequences for Turkey. So haven't they flipped not just once but twice on troop withdrawal? Am I right about that?
Well, the problem with having a boss like Trump is that you always have to jump through hoops and flip and do turns. And we're watching Pompeo do all of this acrobatics on the world stage, and it makes the United States look bad. You know, he's basically, I find it hard to even try to interpret what he's trying to say because it is shifting, as you point out. But basically, if I were going to try to understand Pompeo's logic here, he's got a boss who told no one about a bad idea, which is to announce overnight that you're just going to pull all your troops out because you create a vacuum that Iran and Russia can exploit. And instead he's saying, okay, we're going to phase this thing. It's tactical. And I believe one of the statements he made was that just because you take a couple thousand uniformed personnel out of Syria, that doesn't mean that your U.S. Yeah. interests have changed in the region. Okay, that's true. But it is significant, and it is the question of the vacuum remains on the table. And this this administration is plagued by a president who doesn't understand all of the hydraulics of the Middle East and what it would really mean if we left Syria. No one wants to be in Syria. No one wants the war in Syria to have happened. But it's on now. You pull out too early. Not only do you embolden ISIS, you create a vacuum for Russia, for Iran. I can't see how that's in the interest of the United States.
Well, you know, speaking of Pompeo being in a different place than the president, I don't understand how one aligns what he apparently says to the crown prince in Saudi Arabia and what the president says. It seems to me that the president has said on the murder of Khashoggi, we stand with Saudi Arabia. But then we read the headlines in the New York Times saying that when Pompeo sits down with him, he confronts the crown prince and challenges him on Khashoggi. So what is our policy? What is our position?
I guess the answer is no one knows, and I certainly don't know. But I know it's not uncommon for a secretary of state to have two different ways of messaging. There's one, the way you message to the world from the country you're visiting. There's one where you message to the world back in the United States as a Secretary of State. And there's another one where you quietly negotiate one-on-one with a leader. And that is where you can apply pressure and you can actually put forward a tougher line. And I think to be fair to this administration, you can see a way in which all three of those things can be operating at the same time. And that would not be unusual in diplomacy to be doing that.
You know, just as a side story about Saudi Arabia, this is quite a story over the weekend about the 18-year-old Saudi woman who barricaded herself in a Thai hotel.
Canada.
Yes, yeah. And tell us about this. Winds up in Canada. It was a great story.
It is a great story about something that we don't pay enough attention to, which is what it's like to be a woman living in Saudi Arabia,
yeah.
The tyranny that you suffer from your family, literally, honor killings, as they're known. And I put that in huge quotes. There's no honor in killing a woman for any reason of who they date or how they live their lives or anything like that. But it is a legitimate fear that if you are a woman living in Saudi Arabia and your family has decided you've done something they don't like, whether that's not wearing the hijab, which is the case with this woman, or dating someone who's outside of what they they, the men in the family, determine as an acceptable relationship. Yeah, it is a, it can be as dangerous as a death threat from your own family. And people live in great fear. Women live in great fear inside of Saudi Arabia. So when she fled and ends up in Canada, she should be welcomed with open arms as a for political asylum.
Yeah, I was sorry it was Canada, not us, that was welcoming her with the open arms. Apparently she tried to get to Australia, and that didn't work out so well. And when I read the stories about the Canadians, I made me a little sad that it wasn't the Americans.
Yeah, that she didn't think to come here.
Exactly.
And we know why she didn't. And you know, this thing about Saudi Arabia lies really at the center of the Trump administration's new policies in the Middle East, and both the murder of Khashoggi, this case with the woman, illustrate in two very different ways that this is a regime that is brutal, that doesn't care about human rights, that doesn't care certainly about women's rights, and that if you're going to build your Middle East foreign policy around an axis that puts the House of Saud right at the center, it is fraught with peril, and it can come undone, as we are witnessing in real time.
So, Charlie Sennett, tomorrow is the vote. Theoretically, I guess it could be postponed again. But tomorrow is the vote on Brexit. What's going to happen?
You're asking me tough questions. You know, I'm like,
if I knew the answer, I wouldn't ask you the questions. Unfortunately, I don't. So what is going to happen?
Yeah, we figured you'd have the over-under, Charlie.
That's guessing is what I'm going to say. I think that there is a – we said this, remember, we said the exact same thing last week, and then they postponed the vote.
Right, because she was going to lose.
Saying it's decision time, and it's getting harder and harder to believe. It looked like she's going to lose the last vote. She postponed it. I don't see any major changes in the proposal, so I presume she could lose it here. And if she does lose it, what happens then would be she would have to then go back to the EU and beg for some change, and the EU is in no mood to do that. They said, you guys decided to leave. You have this sort of populist reflexive reaction to our very complex global economy, and you didn't understand the value of being part of the European Union. So no, then it's going to be a hard exit, and that's going to be really bad for the UK's economy, and that's going to really be bad for the world's economy. And so I think what happens tomorrow night is pretty extraordinary, and I presume they'll find some way to muddle through, as the UK always does, a place of great resiliency and thoughtfulness. I can't believe this whole thing can unravel, but we won't know what will happen until it happens. It's just too close to call. It's too hard to read. There are a lot of variables within the very arcane rules of British parliamentary politics on how this could reshape, whether or not there could be a no confidence vote. A pretty cascading set of complex factors will start to pan out, but it's a little hard to predict exactly which way it'll go.
So let me ask an easier question and attribute the fact that I'm asking again to short-term memory issues, because I know we've asked you this.
Yeah.
Why are the leaders of both parties against a revote? It seems to me it continues to be the easiest way out, particularly in light of the fact that polls suggest, of course, polls were wrong last time too, I guess, polls suggest that the people of the UK would reverse themselves. Why are we not having another referendum?
Well, it's a good question. I think one reason is the hard right within the Tory party doesn't want to do that because they know they probably will lose. The hard left within the Labour Party doesn't want to know it because they'll probably lose. Remember, you have to remember the hard left Labour
right.
Party actually wants, it sees wisdom in getting out of the EU. So you have a kind of center mass that voted, a majority voted in favor of this idea of Brexit, of leaving the EU. But that center mass is kind of swirling, and I think the extremes are driving that second referendum as to why there's no clear majority coming out of both Tory and Labour leadership right now. That said, I can't see that it wouldn't make the most sense. I agree with you, Jim. I keep coming back to the same question. What on earth would prevent this from going to another referendum? Hit reset that way. Maybe it's that the EU is just too impatient and they're not going to wait for it because it would take a long time to organize, but I doubt that. I think the EU would love to give UK a chance to rethink this.
So who's going to sink Theresa May's deal, and what's wrong with it?
Well, the way Theresa May's deal would sink would be because she failed to get a convincing program that she can get through her own party.
Okay.
And she's just tried to thread the needle through the middle, and it's not clear that her own party is going to accept that. Cabinet ministers are just openly pushing for the May deal to be defeated and to kind of redo the deal. And so there's going to be a lot of politics. Like, I can guarantee you right now, that parliamentary building in London is boiling with energy and side deals and side meetings, and everything is happening in real time. The question at the end of the day is just going to be, did May pull this off? Can she hold it together? Can she win the confidence of the parliament to get this thing through? Or are they going to reject it, which seems quite possible, maybe even likely, and she's going to have to go back and eat humble pie at the EU and try to cut some other deal? I doubt she's going to be able to do that at the EU, but we're going to have to wait and see.
You know, one last thing. We only have a minute left. I thought the story in the New York Times over the weekend, Brexit in the U.S. shutdown, two governments in paralysis,
yeah.
Two governments paralyzed,
yeah.
Two populist projects stalled, two venerable democracies in crisis, painting the parallels between the dysfunction, the paralysis in the British government and in our government over pretty similar sets of issues around immigration, Charlie.
Yeah. I thought that was a really insightful piece. It's something that we were doing on the last program. We were comparing these two, and I think it's a really interesting way to look at how populism has given rise to both Brexit and the wall, sort of almost like a failure of the culture wars has become an argument around border wars and how we define our borders and this fear of immigration and in the context of a global economy that really plays well to fear, and how the far right and populist movements are using that play to fear, both in the argument for Brexit and for the wall. Really interesting similarities. Great piece. Ellen Berry, former colleague of the Boston Globe.
Oh, that's right. Of course.
Mark Landler.
That's right.
So I thought that story in itself was just extraordinary. And we're all scratching our heads, and we need to step back and look, how will historians write about the moment we live in? They'll look back and they will say these nationalist or almost nativist movements that came forth at this time in history were built on selling fear around immigration policy and global economies that really challenged large swaths of the middle class in both countries and challenged the way we think of each other. So
we got to go.
History's going to write.
Charlie, thank you so much.
Charlie, thank you very much. Charlie is a news analyst here at WGBH, where he heads up the Ground Truth Project. Up next, we're opening the lines and asking you about Trump's latest problems in Russia.
At noon on Boston Public Radio, we open the lines and ask you not about the Manchurian candidate, but the Moscow candidate. The New York Times is reporting the FBI launched an investigation into whether Trump was secretly working on behalf of Russia. We'll open the lines and ask you if you're concerned that a man under investigation for treason, who continues to receive daily intelligence briefings focused on national security, is our president. And it's time for All Revved Up, and look at how the Vatican is weighing whether to defrock Cardinal Theodore McCarrick, once a papal favorite.
From there, TV's Bob Thompson goes over the best and worst TV moments of the week with a big shout-out to PBS. We wrap things up with Guster, the alternative rock band who got its start in Boston, has a new album coming out this week. We'll get a live preview from our Fraser Performance Studio right here at WGBH. All that is next on Boston Public Radio 89.7.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
This is Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello again, Jim.
Hey there. By the way, a lot of you are asking, what's the deal with Guster at 1:30 on the dot today?
1:30. I'm so excited.
They're going to join us and play for us live from their great new album. That's coming again at 1:30 from here at GBH. But first, and this is the President of the United States answering a reporter's question earlier today.
I never worked for Russia. Not only did I never work for Russia, I think it's a disgrace that you even asked that question, because it's a whole big fat hoax. It's just a hoax.
We are now at the point where the president has to assure us that he was never a Russian asset. On Friday, as you know, we discussed this earlier, the New York Times reported the FBI opened an inquiry into whether Trump was working on behalf of Russia. Now the Washington Post is reporting, as we also discussed, that Trump actively concealed the content of some of his meetings with Vladimir Putin. Yes, this is not good news for the president, particularly as he heads into the 2020 election. But then again, does any of this come as a surprise, considering that Trump has been leaving breadcrumbs the size of pierogies connecting him to Russia since he launched his 2016 campaign? Here are just a few. First, he hires Paul Manafort as his campaign manager, a man who spent the last 10 years promoting Russian interests in Ukraine. He openly calls for Russia to hack Hillary Clinton's email. We've seen Putin give Trump the big thumbs up at global summits. And last summer, Trump even thanked Putin for expelling hundreds of staffers out of the American embassy because it resulted in a, quote, smaller payroll, not to mention, obviously, the Russian interference in the 2016 election. Our number is 877-301-8970. Are these latest Russia bombshells actually bombshells, or is this just more of the same? If you're a Trump supporter, does this matter to you at all? If you're a Democrat, is the Russia connection a winning or losing strategy for the Democrats? 877-301-8970. Regardless of what people's answer is, I'll say what I said to Jennifer Becerra and Steve Kerrigan an hour or so ago. This is not the Democratic Party that launched an investigation as to whether or not Donald Trump was wittingly or otherwise working for the Russians. It was the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, after the firing of Comey. And while the president may say it's the most insulting question he's ever been asked, it's the most outrageous article that's ever been written, the fact remains, and no one is disputing it, the FBI, I think it was May of 2017, opened this investigation, and the president of the United States is answering questions. And by the way, not from a hostile reporter. I don't know who the reporter asked the question today. Jeanine Pirro, you can't get any more trumped up than that on Fox News. Asked them the question, I think it was Saturday night that the thing played. It is otherworldly. And the fact, speaking of world, the fact that the world doesn't stop at that moment when the president of the United States is investigated for potentially being an agent of Russia is unbelievable. And by the way, there may be no truth to
there may be no truth.
But what there is total truth to is the investigation was launched.
He could be totally innocent of this. It could be that he was an unwitting pawn of
or
Russia.
Or that nothing happened.
Or that nothing, right, that he just fired Comey.
Well, he said he fired him because of Russia. It doesn't mean that he was doing it at the behest of the Russians.
But the things do add up, as you point out. Right after he fired Comey, he met with Kislyak, the Russian diplomat, and said
the next day or the couple of days later?
Soon thereafter, and that was an off the record meeting where he. But we do know that he talked about the fact that it was great to get rid of James Comey because the pressure was off on Russia. There have been the money things that I mentioned before when Jennifer Saris was here and Steve Kerrigan was here about how the Russians have repeatedly bailed out the Trump corporation, how they spent about $100 million on condos, and that Deutsche Bank, which also gave a lot of money to the Russians, is giving a lot of money to the Trump organization. There's been this weird thing that we talked about, too, about the meeting in Helsinki with Vladimir Putin, where normally normally, presidents sit with other members of their cabinet, and there are other people. It's not just the two leaders in the room alone with interpreters. But in this case, it was the two leaders, Putin and Trump, in the room alone with the interpreters. And then the president requested the transcripts from the interpreter, which is an odd thing.
And didn't he tell the interpreter not to disclose the content?
Yes. And then there was all the talk right after the election. Remember, Jared Kushner was talking about back channels to the Russians, which led some in the FBI to wonder, well, why do they need back channels? Were they going to be getting orders from the Russians on what to do? And, of course, in the Republican platform before he became the president, they altered the platform when it had to do with Ukraine, which is where Paul Manafort was working for all those years. And, of course, we know that Paul Manafort shared polling data, which is not just the polling data, like who's winning and who's losing. It's the internal polling data, which talks a lot about certain parts of which states and what kind of wedge issues that could get people revved up, or in the case it's often been made that discourage people from voting, as many people argue that the Russian interference did too. So there's a lot of these things that kind of add up. Oh, I didn't mention this, that there have been 101 contacts between Trump's team and Russia, and the Trump team lied about or tried to cover up every single one of them. So as many people have pointed out, he's not acting like someone who's got nothing to hide.
877-301-8970. And, you know, the incredible thing, you and I had a little meeting yesterday, and we were talking about the interview with Jeanine Pirro, and we were both remarking on what a lot of people were remarking on until this morning. He didn't answer the question.
He didn't.
And you said, and I hope people don't take this in the wrong way, you said, why didn't he just lie, even if it was true, like he does about so many other things? But I thought the exact same thing. I mean, obviously, he, as many people have said, he doesn't live in yesterday or tomorrow. Mm-hmm. He lives in the moment. And if what was helpful in the moment was to say, of course it's not true, maybe he thought by saying it's the most insulting question I've ever been asked, it's the most insulting thing that's ever been written about me, it was a de facto no. And his defense, maybe that is what he thought. But it was odd to me that he didn't just deny it, but he did deny it this morning. I have never worked for Russia, he says. Not only did I never work for Russia, I think it's a disgrace that you even asked the question. He said as he was about to get on a helicopter. But I'll tell you, I have a lot of respect for Jennifer Becerra. She's entitled to her opinion, very smart person. The fact that there is anybody in this country who is not jarred by the fact, regardless of what your conclusion is, that the Federal Bureau of Investigation debated and then decided to open an investigation as to whether or not the president of the United States was working with Russia, was an unwitting pawn of Russia, was something of Russia, to me is unbelievable.
I remember it wasn't long after this whole thing that Ron Rosenstein joked about wearing a wire. We think he was joking, I don't know, about wearing a wire to record the president. There are unusual situations. And one last thing, and then we'll get to the calls at 877-301-8970. You could argue that the president's overnight announcement that he's pulling troops out of Syria helps the Russians in Syria as well. Anyway, let's start with Roger in Marblehead. Hi, Roger.
Hi, good morning, guys.
Hi.
I want to remind you that we met in the library last week.
Oh, great. Oh, yes.
Oh, you
Hi,
were the
Roger.
Guy who suggested they should shut down the whole government, right?
No, I suggested there should be barricades and protests in front of Trump Tower.
Oh, that is what you said. Yeah, my apologies. That's right. Yeah, it was good to meet you, Roger. It was a good call, too.
All related. Yeah.
So what do you got this week?
I just wanted to say that it dawned on me, I was driving in the car when your show started, that we're literally living in like the Truman Show. This presidency from day one, from the day that clown came down the escalator in Trump Tower, that this thing has been produced, stage managed as a reality TV show. It's not even a presidency. And that we're going to be, you know, you're not going to need historians to examine this presidency because you're just going to be watching it on reruns for generations to come.
I mean, well,
the whole thing.
Go ahead. Go ahead. No, you go ahead.
And I was just going to, it just struck me as well that that when this guy's presidency is done, and hopefully that's much sooner rather than later, you're not going to build a presidential library for this guy. It's going to have to be a library. I mean, this guy is every day, every minute of every second of the day. It's just one lie after the next, and I'm pretty convinced that he's a traitor at the end of the day, and bad things or good things don't happen to traitors.
Well, two things. So, one, thank you for your call, obviously, and that is a pretty good line. I wish I had come up with that. And secondly, we have no idea. We just don't, and that's why Bob Mueller is there. You used the term traitor. We have no idea if he was unduly influenced by Russia, if he chose to work with Russia, or if there was any connection other than from the Russian side of the equation. But that's why we have Mueller. And the thing that's heartening, Roger, and thank you for your call, is William Barr, who is the president's nominee to be the next attorney general, who I think is testifying in front of the Senate next Tuesday and Wednesday, the confirmation hearings, has said in the last 24 hours, even though he's been very critical as a private citizen of the Mueller investigation, that not only does he want the Mueller investigation to reach its natural conclusion, but that within certain bounds, and I don't know what that exactly means, he believes there should be as much transparency with the report as possible, both in terms of its release to Congress and to the American people, because I think a lot of people do not know they're all waiting nervously, regardless of your point of view, for the Mueller report. It goes to the Department of Justice, to the Attorney General, and he could decide not to release any of it, not just to us, but to Congress. That doesn't mean that the House wouldn't, the Democratic House wouldn't subpoena Mueller or pieces of this, but assuming that Barr means that, I think that's a heartening statement from the Attorney General nominee.
Robert E. Mielsen says, it's probably true that he never worked for Russia. He might have just volunteered for Russia. There's a big difference. Stephen says he doesn't buy that he worked for Russia for a minute because surely the Russians could have found a more competent secret agent.
You know, Jennifer, I don't want to put words in her mouth, but she was criticizing the FBI for having done this. You should read the CNN report, which I didn't have when we were talking, about how this was not just the rogue behavior of one leader of the FBI. CNN has gotten a hold of transcripts of debates internally amongst the senior leaders there about whether or not this was a good idea. So this was, again, this was a decision made by a number of longtime veterans of law enforcement in this country that it was appropriate to start an investigation. And I repeat, we have no idea what the conclusion is. We know it's passed along to Bob Mueller, and we have yet to know what he has concluded.
You know, we know here in Boston better than most because of the FBI's disgraceful performance in the Whitey Bulger case that the FBI makes mistakes. But I just don't see this. I never bought these, you know. First of all, I would imagine there was an awful lot of FBI people that were Trump voters that were not Hillary voters that might have preferred Donald Trump to Hillary Clinton for economic reasons, if for any reasons.
But I hope that it wouldn't cause them to say
no,
if the merits were such that an investigation made sense, there shouldn't be one because I voted for the president.
Well, what I'm saying is I find it hard to believe that the heads of the Justice Department or the heads of the FBI are in these conspiracy things. Let's go out and get Trump. It just doesn't ring true to me.
877-301-8970. So I want to know what your reaction was to the news in the New York Times. Then there was the Jeanine Pirro question. In fact, can we play both these things?
But by the way,
if you tuned in later, here is the interview that played Saturday night with Jeanine Pirro asking Donald Trump a question relating to this. And when that's done, we'll play you what Trump said in response to a question before he got on the helicopter this morning. Here's the Pirro interview on Fox News.
Have you ever worked for Russia, Mr. President?
I think it's the most insulting thing I've ever been asked. I think it's the most insulting article I've ever had written. And if you read the article, you'd see that they found absolutely nothing. But the headline of that article, it's called The Failing New York Times for a reason. They've gotten me wrong for 3 years. They've actually gotten me wrong for many years before that.
Okay, and virtually every observer said it was interesting that he didn't go out of his way to say, no, I did not. But he did this morning in response to a reporter's question as he was about to board a helicopter. Here it is.
I never worked for Russia. Not only did I never work for Russia, I think it's a disgrace that you even asked that question. Because it's a whole big fat hoax. It's just a hoax.
I don't know. What is the big fat hoax, I assume, is that he says he didn't work for them.
The Russia investigation is a hoax.
Oh, I see.
Even though we've had a bunch of people, you know, Carter Page, George Papadopoulos, Paul Manafort, Rick Gates, Michael Flynn, who have all been involved.
Michael Cohen
have pled or been involved with law enforcement. Roger Stone, who's quite the character. He was in contact with this, with Russian conduit WikiLeaks. And WikiLeaks is the one that released all those emails of John Podesta, which got Hillary Clinton in hot water.
And Stone apparently knew in advance that they were about to be released.
And the day that Trump on the campaign trail said, let's see if we can find Hillary Clinton's emails. That was a day.
Urge Russia to do it.
Yes.
I have to say, and I don't know, and I'm trying to probe his mind, I thought he meant that as a joke, even though that's on everybody's list of things that suggest that he has an unholy relationship to Russia. It was a poor joke, but I thought he meant it as a joke.
But the timing of them suddenly looking at the emails is rather odd.
Let's go to Tim in Rye, New Hampshire. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Thank you very much for calling, Tim. Hi.
Good morning, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I listen to your show whenever I can. I'm always at work, so sometimes I can't call in or can't listen. Anyways, back to Trump.
Sure.
Nothing he does surprises me. I mean, the day shortly before he was inaugurated in January 2017, the guy wrote a check for $25 million to settle claims of fraud and racketeering.
Is the Trump University thing you're talking about?
Yes.
Yeah, man. Yeah, of course it is. And like, what were people thinking? They didn't think that was unusual. And that what about the fact that the guy went bankrupt 6 times and couldn't get a dime from a bank in the United States? And then his own son tells Golf Magazine a few years ago, "Oh, we have no problem buying these expensive golf courses. We get all our money from Russia." The guy is, I don't know if he's an agent. He's not smart enough to be an agent, but he's definitely a puppet.
Tim, thanks for the call. By the way, for those who hadn't heard those comments before, both Eric and Donald Jr. Yeah. made comments like that.
Here's
about
Eric,
the ease of getting money from the Russians.
Here's what Eric Trump said in 2014. "We don't rely on American banks. We have all the funding we need out of Russia." Yeah. That was Eric.
It was. 877.
And Donald said, Russians,
Don Jr.,
Russians make up a pretty disproportionate cross-section of a lot of our assets. And don't forget, we now know that the president was trying to build a Trump Tower over there with a $50 million penthouse apartment on the top.
And again, we do know that the Russian leadership interfered in our election. These are facts. We don't know what the result of this FBI investigation was. It has been passed on to Mueller. But the mere fact that it exists is just, it's staggering to me. And, you know, it's almost like, I don't know what the alternative is, but the fact that the world goes on as normal and it's considered another news event.
Can you imagine if the FBI opened an investigation that Barack Obama was in the tank with Kenya, where he was supposedly born? Well, not Kenya, because it's a little tiny country. This isn't going to have it's not a big world player. But I mean, if he was in the tank with Russia.
Well, Russia. I mean, Jennifer was right. He made that comment that I think he thought was not going to be heard by a reporter. Remember that comment? After the election, yep. We'll have more maneuverability or whatever he said, which I thought was an inappropriate comment. But I agree with you. It would seem to me that the whole country, I would hope in bipartisan fashion, would be up in arms if any president. Again, we want to hear the results, but the fact that we just move on like it's another
news cycle.
But, you
know, it's everything. I mean, think about this. I mean, a lot of these presidents, we all know a lot of them have had fooled around and had affairs and stuff. But it's really unusual for one to have an alleged affair with a Playboy bunny and a porn star in the same weekend, in the same and have to pay them both off.
You were there. She was there. He was there. So
yeah, he was there. You know, yeah. Usually it's and
well, try to make the best use of your time. When you have limited, I mean, I've always found if you can do two things while you're, you know, really just
yeah.
877-301-8897. We're talking about the story that broke in the New York Times. I guess it was on Friday about the FBI starting. I think it was in May 17. 2017, right after the firing of Comey, an investigation into whether or not the president was an agent of the Russians, working with the Russians, wittingly, unwittingly, and that was followed, I guess, 24 to 36 hours later by the Washington Post story about the president taking away the notes of the interpreter of at least one of his meetings with Vladimir Putin and telling him or her that they should not share that with anybody. You know, it's one thing that the American people don't know what happened in those meetings. At least the reports I read, his senior advisors
correct.
Don't know what happened in those meetings. 877-301-8970. And by the way, we're taking calls as we always do in the order in which they come. We'll make an exception if somebody who calls in, and the lines are all full, but as soon as one opens up, who believes this is much ado about not much and that the FBI is this corrupt enterprise and you shouldn't spend a minute on this, we will take you out of order. So there's a little more balance, but I don't really know where the balance comes from here. Brendan in the car, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey.
Hey, Jim and Marjorie.
Hi.
I hope all is well. So I think, you know, whether or not Trump is a Russian agent is sort of erroneous if he's going to govern as if he is one. You know, I think odds are pretty good that the Mueller report is going to draw that conclusion. But even if it doesn't and it fully exonerates him, look, he's anti-NATO. He's pro-autocrat. If it's not necessarily because they got dirt on him, he clearly has some type of affection, whether it's ideological or politically, for Putin, for Russia. And I think that's the question for the American public if the Mueller report does. I think is unlikely. Do we want a president that's going to represent Russia's interests more than ours?
And your point, I mean, he has the Russian position on NATO. He has the Russian position on Afghanistan. He has the Russian position on Syria. But in fairness to him, I guess at least on the Afghanistan-Syrian front, this is sort of a variation of what Andrew Bacevich said to us the other day. The guy campaigned as one who was going to, long before we knew about the Putin connection, or at least the sort of bro kind of relationship they seem to have from time to time, he campaigned on the notion that he wanted to pull out of these places.
Right. Well, I think Bacevich's objection, and correct me if I'm wrong, was not that he wanted to get out of Syria, was how he announced getting out of Syria. Kind of an
overnight.
And
then he had no plan. And,
an overnight kind of thing, and not talking to your allies about this and how it was going to be conducted, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Because Andrew Bacevich has long argued, and he's a great professor at Boston University, as long emeritus, I think he is at this point, has long argued that we are wasting our blood and treasure on these never-ending, forever wars, and what is the end game?
Well, we've said the same thing with far less substantive knowledge.
Well, Barack Obama ran on getting out of Iraq and Afghanistan, too, and often when they get in there, it doesn't turn out that way. Anyway, we're talking about Trump and the latest reporting of the New York Times and the Washington Post that details his questionable dealings with Russia. We're going to keep talking about it on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, broadcasting live. No, we're not. We're here in the studio, actually, in Brighton.
Back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're talking about Trump and his latest Russia woes from the New York Times reporting the FBI investigated if Trump is working on behalf of Russia, and the Washington Post following up reporting that Trump went out of his way to conceal what he and Putin discussed over the course of several meetings since Donald Trump became president. 877-301-8970. Where are you on this? Is this just more of the same? Are you withholding judgment until the Mueller investigation comes out? And if you didn't read the New York Times story, rather than Marjorie and I characterizing it, let me just read you the first paragraph of the story from January 11th, just a few days ago. In the days after President Trump fired James Comey as FBI director, law enforcement officials became so concerned by the president's behavior they began investigating whether he'd been working on behalf of Russia against American interests, according to former law enforcement officials and others familiar with the investigation. And Comey was fired in May of 2017. To me, it is an historic moment, regardless of how Robert Mueller decides the issue.
We have to go back and look at our American history, but I don't, was there another president that was thought to be a foreign agent?
Not that I'm aware. I think a Manchurian candidate may have been, but that was a fictional.
That was a movie. It wasn't real life. I could be wrong. I don't recall one. Maybe someone can tell us if they know about one.
877-301-8970. I'm sorry, Margaret.
Let's go to Reed in North Andover.
Hi, Reed.
Good morning.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that I thought it was odd at the beginning of the Trump campaign that he had chosen so many people with a relationship with Russia. And I now realize I was naive. I believe that Paul Manafort is as compromised as Trump is, and that all these other people were assigned to the campaign through Russian handlers. I think that's how they got there. I think Putin helped him assemble this team for that very reason. These people are all back channel conduits into the campaign, and now those that are left into our government.
Well, I have no idea if any of that is true, and I surely hope it is not. There are a lot of Russian connections. And Reed, thank you for the call. Should read the great piece that Andy Borowitz, America's at least our favorite satirist, wrote the other day.
No,
that to break the logjam over the shutdown, that Nancy Pelosi decided to cut out the middleman, and she was going to negotiate the resolution directly with Vladimir Putin. So. Why go through Donald Trump when she could deal with a decision maker directly. It's funny, but it's really not that funny at all. 877-301-897. You know what's also not funny at all? Speaking about the reaction that people are having to this, while there is no factual, there is a factual basis, obviously, to suggest, not suggest, to demonstrate that the FBI did open an investigation, there is no factual basis to conclude that he is a Russian agent. Could somebody still on the line, if you can get rid of them, that call, please, in our ear. Thank you. What is indisputable, which seems to have just totally watered down the whatever it's called, is the Russians interfered in our election.
Correct.
They had access to, what, 126 million people on Facebook? Well, we don't have any idea, even though I read a story over the weekend that suggests that they have proved, based on some scientific research, that there was an impact on the outcome. I've never seen anything convincing to suggest there was an impact other than the fact that there were the contact. That's almost, or you used to ask the question all the time, every time we had somebody in, are we better, a member of Congress, are we better prepared for, oh, it was 2016, 2018 you asked about. Well, 2018 is now over.
Yeah,
are we better prepared for 2020 that there not be Russian influence in our presidential decision making then?
Well, 2018 seems to be mostly about voter suppression. But I have no idea if there were people. We certainly haven't heard about it in 2018 of Russian influence. Maybe they're waiting until 2020. I have no idea.
Bill and Sudbury, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Thank you. Welcome to the show. Hi.
Hello. Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Not only are we at this weird place where the president has been being investigated for counterintelligence, but we're also at a place where the president's denials are almost meaningless. Not many people believe him anymore when he denies it.
Yeah. Well, he does have a credibility problem. That's been documented over and over again, that I forget the percentage, but considering numbers of Americans don't think he's truthful.
The whole thing that they didn't tell me, all counterintelligence investigations are secret. Of course they didn't tell him.
Yeah. Well, again, you know, it's very likely. I mean, I find it hard to believe that Donald Trump is a Russian agent. I think he might have been an unwitting help to the Russians, and not that I have any inside information. But the fact that they even began this investigation at some point, maybe they've ended it, maybe we don't know if they've ended it or not, is just pretty shocking.
So I'm sorry, go ahead. Yeah, finish.
Why doesn't he just cop to it? Why doesn't he say that in the beginning of this process, when I didn't have any supporters, anybody who came through the door, I was welcoming, and some shady Russians came in, and I was a little slow to react.
Well, I would say the reason he doesn't cop to it, to use your term, Bill, is because he denies it. So, and until we have proof from Bob Mueller to the contrary, his denial is as credible as anything else. But you're right; he did tell 7,000 lies, according to the Washington Post. In his first 2 years in office. Bill, thank you much for the call. But, you know, the one connection, you touched on this before, since a year ago maybe, 18 months ago, Juliette Kayyem has been saying follow the money. And there are a lot of Russian financial connections into the Trump organization. And that doesn't prove anything. It's just circumstances. It's environmental information, but the quotes from Donald Trump Jr. and Eric Trump, the purchases with cash that have been made by the Russians through the years from the Trump organization.
Yeah, was it $100 million worth of $109 million worth of properties? That's a lot of money.
Well, I think it's more than that. I think that's with cash. Is that not what they say there?
Yes, cash. All cash purchases. Yeah. A red flag for potential money laundering. That's one of the theories, is that a lot of the condos in the Trump Tower in New York City are money laundered apartments belonging to Russians who paid with cash. And there's the Suns talking about how they don't have to worry about getting money from American banks because they get all their money through all the funding we need out of Russia, said Eric Trump in 2014. But I get back to that tax story that got no play.
Was that because of
Kavanaugh?
Kavanaugh, yeah.
But, you know, you basically see Trump becoming a landlord at the age of like 7 or something. He was a millionaire by the time he was 9. It was all having to do with his father. And that his father was the big genius behind the Trump empire, and that Trump would drive these reporters around and say, oh, look at my building here. Oh, look at my building there. And in fact, it wasn't his building. It was his father's building. And his father repeatedly bailed him out. And when Trump was losing millions and millions and millions of dollars, suddenly he had a huge income, and the income was because he and his siblings sold the father's real estate empire, which was massive. But before they stole the empire, Trump tried to shaft his own father, who bailed him out over and over again, and change the will. And the elder Trump had the wherewithal, even at his advanced age, to say, hold on, hold on, and get the other siblings in there to make sure that Donald Jr. couldn't, or Donald, whatever he is, he's not his father's Fred Trump, that Donald couldn't shaft.
Donald as in the soon-to-be future president.
Yes, could not shaft his siblings, but it was the father. It wasn't Trump.
Yeah, we were talking about lying a couple of minutes ago and the number of lies the Washington Post has detected. The one to me that was most suggestive of the notion that it may be pathological, which is the building that he said had more floors. Is it Trump Tower?
Oh, yeah. He lied about how many floors there were. Because he wanted it to be a bigger size skyscraper than it is. I think he added on, what, 8 floors or something like that?
Brooke, I don't know where you're calling from, but welcome to the show. Thank you so much. Hi. Hi, Brooke.
Oh, hi. It's Barbara.
Oh, Barbara. Sorry, our fault. Hi, Barbara. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. You know, I don't know why we are surprised at this. We shouldn't be. We've been prepared. He's told us everything about him from day one, starting with the day he made that statement that he could stand outside of Park Avenue and Madison Avenue, whatever street.
Fifth Avenue, but that's okay.
Fifth Avenue, and shoot somebody and still get away with it. I do believe the man is capable of anything. I don't think he's very intelligent, so I don't really think he is a Russian agent. As a matter of fact,
by the way, he was smart enough to get elected president of the United States, Barbara, for whatever that's worth.
Which will probably always be a mystery to me, but that goes to show you where we are in this country. I do believe that. I hate to say it, but it really does go to show you where at least half of the population is in this country in regards to how he did get elected. But I don't believe the man has a sense of scruples. I really don't. I think he's capable of anything and everything because he really only cares about how much power he can have and what he can say. Whatever he wants to do, whatever he wants to say, he does it. I mean, his
personal life is a shambles. Yeah, but Barbara, there are a lot of behaviors that you may, it sounds like from your bent here, would criticize. To me, they're all in one side of the equation. The other side of the equation is the issue raised in the New York Times piece about potentially being an agent of the Russian government. That's a different kettle of fish than being self-serving.
My name is Bond.
I would argue it's
James
even different than emoluments, even though they're banned by the Constitution. This is a pretty serious thing. But again, we should say, despite the conclusion that a lot of you, and it sounds like you, Barbara, have made, there is no conclusion. The only fact we know about this is the FBI started an investigation in May of 2017 and was ultimately passed on to Robert Mueller. We have no idea how he has or will conclude on that issue. But Barbara, thank you much
for
the
call. But
you know,
I always defend the election of Donald Trump for a couple of reasons. Hillary Clinton was not the most inspiring candidate. Donald Trump ran as a populist, as I wrote in the Globe the other day. He's governed like Marie Antoinette.
You had a lot of comments on that story, by the way. I don't know if you noticed, like hundreds and hundreds. Yeah.
You know, given tax breaks to the millionaires and billionaires, et cetera, et cetera. But the Democrats ignored the travails of the middle class, or the Republicans under Trump have ignored them too, but at least that was Trump's shtick running as a populist. He was going to help the forgotten man. I think
why are you bringing that up now?
Because Barbara just said she can't believe people voted for him. I can. I mean, he's an entertainer. He's a television star. He knows brilliantly how to be in front of the camera.
There's another reason they voted for him, and I know this upsets Hillary Clinton supporters. The best line, which I've repeated 1,000 times, by Trevor Noah, said Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, they're running, the two luckiest people on the planet, they're running against the only person they could ever possibly beat. They were the two least popular candidates in the history of presidential polling. Sonia on the Pike, you're next and I think last on this topic on Boston Public Radio. Hi there.
Good morning.
Hi. You're on, Sonia.
The firing of James Comey was not exactly the first sign that Trump was a little bit off when it came to Russia. I mean, turn back the clock a generation, Republicans would have been stunned, right? Stunned to find a member of their party behaving in this bizarre way toward Russia, be whether a Democrat or Republican.
You don't have to turn the clock back far at all. I think you turn the clock back a day before that. Yeah.
Right. And this has been incredibly unpatriotic, okay? Forget illegal or legal. To me, this is just incredibly unpatriotic. And when I saw that story in the Times the other day, I thought, remember when we all laughed when Trump said, oh, I think Trump Tower is bugged? Well,
I mean, the Obama thing.
It was goofy, and it was a story that was quickly denied and forgotten. But it's very funny. The other morning when I was reading that article, I thought, that's the first thing that popped into my mind. I said, oh, gee, we were all laughing when we thought that Trump was booked in Trump Tower. Now it doesn't even sound funny anymore. It's amazing how things that just a short time ago sounded utterly ridiculous are happening, and this is our new reality. It's like you're saying, Tim, this is so stunning that the world just continues to go on every day.
Well, Sonia, thank you for the call. I don't have an alternative as to how we should behave. Should we not go to work? Should we just stay in bed? Should we sit on the couch on our underwear? I don't know what it is. It just seems to me this New York Times story was a major story that, at least in my estimation, got not much more attention than any day story on Donald Trump.
It's not every day that somebody says this is
the President of the United States is an agent of a foreign government.
Yeah, think about that. Who are the other secret agents besides James Bond?
First of all, they did not, we got to be clear, they did not say that he was. They chose
an investigation, and it's very likely that he has absolutely been exonerated. He is not a secret agent.
We don't know if it's likely or not.
Or that he was an unwitting secret agent. Who else besides James Bond? Sean Connery. Remember, can you do the James Bond? I'm James Bond.
No, I'm not going to do any more imitations. I was humiliated the other day. I was.
I think you did a very nice job.
He was being nice to me. I did Mr. Ed, and he was nice to me.
Okay, coming up, we're going to talk with Irene Munro, take on the moral issues of the day, including whether the movie Green Book was a whitewash of the past to make the film a populist favorite. We're going to talk about that and much more with Irene up next on 89.7 WGBH. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan here with us in Studio 3 to take on the moral dilemmas of the day is Reverend Irene Munro. She's a syndicated religion columnist, the Boston voice for Detour's African-American Heritage Trail, and a visiting researcher in the Religion and Conflict Transformation Program at BU School of Theology. She, along with Emmett Price, join us every Monday for All Revved Up. Emmett is not here today. He'll be back next week. Irene said, and I don't believe her, that he ceded all of his time.
Yes, he did.
To her.
Knowing that he would never be able to get it back. So I am glad to be here, but not without him.
I know. We miss him.
Good to see you,
back
Irene.
Next time. So I'm dying to talk to you about this movie Green Book. It's become very popular. It's mentioned for the upcoming Academy Awards, Peter Farrelly's book.
And Hursula Ali got a Golden Globe for it.
That's right. He's a really good actor.
Oh, he was definitely.
He was in that.
And in movies.
Oh, was it good?
Is it good?
I only watched
excellent.
The first hour.
And he was in that other one that won the Academy Award.
Moonlight. Absolutely. Yeah. You know what he is? He's our contemporary. I'm so old school. But Belafonte.
Well, he was in House of Cards, too, by the way. That's where most of us met him.
Really?
In House of Cards, yeah.
Okay. So anyway, there's a lot of controversy surrounding Green Book. Tell us why, Irene.
Okay. Well, people need to know the premise of it. It's where you have this kind of bigoted Italian American who's hired as a driver and a bodyguard for pianist Don Shirley. Now, a lot of white folks don't know Don Shirley, but he's a classically trained African American pianist, and he's also gay. And so the problem with the story is that it's really the white version of driving Miss is Daisy. So here you have this northern, you know, guy, the guy from the north, never been south, is going to drive him through the south using what is called the Negro Motorist Guidebook. Are you familiar?
Yes, the Green Book.
Do you know where to stop and stay and all that? And so, of course, as we were saying before we got on the air, it's a kind of retake like of The Help, as if this guy, you know, lived in isolation. The family is a big kerfuffle about it.
Shirley's family.
Yeah. Because it gives us a notion that he was estranged not only from his black family, and one can think, not, you know, understanding that he's gay, that perhaps he was because he was gay, but that is not the case. That he's disconnected from the black community. Did you see the movie?
No, I did not.
It was suspect because here was this guy, supposedly, you know, clueless about the ways of the South. He grew up in the South. And then when he gets into real trouble, he's able to call one of the Kennedy boys. That suggests that this guy is pretty connected here. But it devalues the narrative of what the importance of the Green Book, how that saved so many lives here. And again, using what we call that trope of the, you know, white hero.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, you see this over and over again. I mean, we talked about it before we went on the air. This was so obvious in The Help, which is the movie of all these black maids who were really sticking their necks out because they were going to get fired and lose their jobs. And sometimes they did. And some of them got rescued by this white woman writing a book about them. She wasn't sticking her neck out at all. The maids were. Or Mississippi Burning, which is another one of those.
And to forget that even in Don Shirley's narrative, as well as the help, that the civil rights movement was afoot. It's just as simple as that.
And by the way, I thought to you, but maybe someone else last week, that Viola Davis, who obviously stars in The Help, has subsequently said she regrets having
made it for the reasons you're talking about. She absolutely should. And I understand that, you know, she was born on a plantation, raised in Rhode Island, and that her mother was a maid. And I understand that Octavia Spencer, as we well know, got the award for Best Supporting Actress for playing a maid. You know, on some level, I get it because remember what Hattie Daniels said when she won her award
and Gone with the Wind.
She said, "I'd rather play a maid than be a maid." But that's the 1930s. We're talking about, you know, 2015 here and stuff. So Viola bothered me when she rescinded, largely because I know she knows this history. She's not clueless.
Yeah. Have you seen the other one, If Beale Street Could Talk?
Oh, my God. It is just absolutely a wonderful love story. What I loved about it, I just have to say, is that what we don't depict in terms of black suffering is that there's love that goes on.
Yeah.
And it's a hard love because we can't protect our loved ones. And here is this gentleman, this poor guy, Fonnie, who's, you know, accused of a crime, as we hear a lot. Yeah, that's another kind of racial trope for a crime he didn't do, and he's in jail.
Yeah, he's in jail. It's based on a James Baldwin.
Yeah.
I think it's a short story.
It is. Well, it's a novel. It's a novel.
Oh, it's a novel.
Yeah,
okay.
It's a novel.
We're talking to Irene Munn.
I thought it could have moved a little faster.
Oh, it could. And it came out in the 70s. It's a very different kind of novel. It wasn't one of his protest kind of narratives.
So we're talking to Irene Monroe, and it's now Pope Watch time, and Emmett is not here for this, so we're depending on you, Irene.
I'm going to use his voice, too.
I hope you do.
Okay.
Theodore McCarrick, the ex-cardinal, here's the headline from the Washington Post. The Vatican moves quickly towards punishing ex-cardinal McCarrick for sexual abuse. He faces the prospect of being defrocked, which in English means not only would he not be a priest, he loses his church-funded housing, financial support.
Laicize is the word they said.
How big a deal would this be if they were to take? That's a rather extreme move, even though it seems to me to be deserved. A rather extreme move for the hierarchy of the Catholic Church.
Moving quick, this is all PR. As we know that in February, from this February coming, the 21st to the 24th, there's going to be this big sort of
the bishops
at the Vatican to talk about child abuse.
Talking to each other.
So I think you need a kind of, you know, check, like we got one. But the point about it is that they've known of this guy for decades. Even the guy that succeeded him also knew about it. But I think what we're trying to do is do the impossible. Because what we're trying to do is get a culture. And we got to admit that within the Vatican, there is a rape culture. So we're asking people who have... We're asking even these bishops, who may very well have been victims of rape or have been predators themselves, to correct a problem that is very systemic.
We should be clear here, by the way, and please correct me, one of you two, if I'm wrong. McCarrick, what McCarrick accused of is not just one of these supervisory, turning the other eye, turning a blind eye, but of actually abusing several minor, and minors, from what I understand.
Oh, absolutely. 300, yeah, like 300, what, not indictments, but 300 people came forward.
Yeah, sexually. You know, the interesting question here, and I know this is for some beating a dead horse, but until it's resolved, to me, it's an open question. We still have not seen an investigation. We brought this up with the Attorney General at least two occasions, of the position taken by Cardinal O'Malley through his secretary, that two letters about sexual abuse, one about McCarrick, were not acted on by Cardinal O'Malley because, according to his secretary, he never passed the letters on to Cardinal O'Malley. Do you not think we are entitled to some sort of investigation as to what he knew, if anything, and when he knew it?
I think the Helen Drynan piece, who's the head of Simmons College in the Globe, said that the Catholic Church has to divide itself, priests and bishops, and of course it would be nice if there were some women in there, but in any case, they can do the pastoral end of things, and they have to have professionals in there running
the forward, but again, do you not have interest? I would hope everybody has interest.
Well, I guess what I'm saying,
actually knew about this.
You know, the lead of this story in the Washington Post talks about how they're going to punish the cardinal for sexual abuse, sentencing the cleric in its secretive justice system. That's the problem. They can't be running a secretive justice system. They can't have the priests and the bishops deciding these things. They need to bring in lay people and professional people to run the criminal end, you know, to supervise criminal end of this, and to run the business end of things. They just can't do it.
They need to clean house. And so the one of the things that we're not understanding is, how do you clean up a rape culture? And I think that once we can address that, I think we can have, as you're saying, different types of people come in and do the kind of not only investigative work, but the kind of spiritual development in terms of bringing back parishioners, also addressing those that have been abused by this. You know, there was a study that was out that said that the psychosexual development of most priests is arrested. So and so if you're growing up in a culture that's their seminary, that's the church, these men are as well-intended or frightened that they may be of being laicized, that they might be, they're not equipped to do it. They're just not equipped to do it.
Talking to Irene Monroe.
Okay, let us move on. Let's go to this nun, speaking of the Catholic Church, who's running this shelter and down at the
God
border.
God bless her.
And she wanted the president to come and visit the shelter, and she wanted to at least be able to talk to him about the kind of suffering she sees every day. She got to do neither.
Well, wasn't she also told that she would get access
to
the president?
She thought she was going to. She thought she was going to be able to talk to the president, and then she ended up just having to sit there silently while some pastor from 6.5 hours away told him he was doing a great job.
Now, are we surprised? This woman is doing justice work. This is a president has used the word infestation. I mean, he's dehumanized them in so many ways. He's called them, what, rapists, criminals, drug dealers. He's saying that, the gang, MS-13, is crossing the borders. I think to date, unfortunately, two children have died. Is it due to dehydration or something happened?
I don't think we know why.
Okay. All right. So, and then again, in his effort, he's got this sort of doggedness about building the wall. And we all remember running a campaign, you know, slogan on Mexico would pay. So, I mean, we can't expect Donald to change Donald. We need the Republican Party to do something.
You know, it's interesting. There was a story over the weekend. I don't have it in front of me, but the essence of it was that while we're obsessing over the southern border, where about 6 terrorists supposedly have come in over the border, that 41 come in over the northern border, and whole swaths of the Canadian border are totally unpatrolled. And even though it's bigger than the southern border, they have far fewer agents, et cetera. So that was an interesting sidebar.
But you know what? But you're talking logic. One of the things is that he's really pandering to his base. So this will be a kind of pyrrhic victory, because if indeed he gets his border wall, it will be at a tremendous loss.
By the way, her name is Sister Norma Pimentel, P-I-M-E-N-T-E-L, and she's not just an activist; she's the executive director of Catholic Charities.
That's right.
Of the Rio Grande Valley. You know, we only have 3 or 4 minutes left. Can you tell the story of the Groveland Four and who have gotten, I guess, some level of
bittersweet
justice from the newly elected Republican Governor DeSantis in Florida. Tell us who they are for those who don't know.
Yeah, and so in 1949, four boys were accused. We've heard this kind of narrative before boys, and I need to say the names because of the pox on their family, the heavy burden that they've carried. But these four boys, Ernest Thomas, Samuel Shepard, Charles Greenlee, and Walter Irvin, were accused of raping this white woman. So apparently what happened in this town in Florida is that one of the stories, there are different strands here. One narrative strand is that their car broke down, okay, and apparently these boys beat up the driver, meaning the woman's husband, and raped her. What most people believe is this, that her husband beat her when they also did a gynecological study. There was no even suggestion of rape, any signs of rape. But unfortunately, the sheriff at that time ran one of the boys out that he went 200 miles chasing him.
And shot him in the head.
Torch black homes. So you know what this reminds us of? Tulsa, Oklahoma, right? Rosewood. We've the narrative to kill a mockingbird captures that kind of repeated story that we see here. But now it is 2019. It's 50 years later. But it's a heavy burden. It has destroyed families, generations.
70 years later, actually, 70, from
that's
this
right.
one. And by the way, the interesting thing about this hearing, where ultimately they determined that there would be, was it pardons, I guess is the term of art, in Florida, the white teen who contended she was raped, Norma Padgett, and continues to contend, was actually at the hearing. And despite that fact, and this is, I'm actually pleased to some degree. I know it's late in coming. Obviously, it's very late in coming. But the fact that they were willing to do it there, particularly with her presence and saying, I've been called a liar, but I am not, was pretty amazing.
But though, in some ways, her story holds up. I mean, her story that she's not lying, because my understanding of it is that it's not that she lied. So this is this overall. This is why they're being.
What is it then?
It's that the boys did not receive a fair trial. So in many.
No, but that's the splitting of the baby that the governor is doing there.
But that's my point, though. I wanted a full throated
so
kind
I.
of acquittal. So in many ways, it keeps that narrative alive that she may have. We just did the boys for whatever the reasons may be. You know, didn't get a full trial. So that's the thing that bothers me. It still hovers over the family.
I think that's a good point.
Yeah, and also that the two of these guys that appealed their sentences, they were being driven back to the courthouse for their new trial, and the sheriff shot them both.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Killing one instantly.
Yeah.
And the other one, the sheriff claiming they were trying to escape, and the guy who played dead and survived said, no, they weren't trying to escape. And he eventually died at 41 from his untreated gunshot wounds.
That's right.
It just makes you
and,
sick.
And, two things. James Baldwin's movie Go See, because it carries that narrative.
It's a criminal justice story.
Absolutely. And then there's a book. This was one of the number one books for 2018 is An American Marriage. Mm-hmm. It's a more contemporary version of this similar kind of story. A buppy, couple go down to New Orleans and the guy in the narrative happens to go over to the concession stand to go get some soda or whatever, and we find out that he's accused of rape. He didn't rape the woman, but given the laws, even in 2018, is incarcerated.
Irene, nice to see you.
Yeah, I miss my buddy here.
I know, he'll be back.
He'll be back.
Irene is a syndicated religion columnist, the Boston's voice for Detour's African American Heritage Trail, and a visiting researcher in the Religion and Conflict Transformation Program at BU's School of Theology. She and Emmett Price join us every week for All Revved Up. Up next, our TV man, Bob Thompson, joins us for the latest, the best and worst TV moments of the week. He is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Could a generation of great television, from The West Wing to The Wire, have ever come to be, turning us all into TV connoisseurs along the way, if it were not for this?
Where the f*** is Paulie?
He called an hour ago. I swear to God, he said he's on his way.
Where the f*** isn't he here now?
Jesus, Tony. You don't think Paulie jumped the gun?
Shut up. God forbid. God forbid. Don't talk like that. Where's Pushy? Get him on the phone. Get him on the phone.
All right. I haven't seen him since Paulie took him to the Schwitz.
Hey, fellas.
Where the f*** have you been? I've been calling you all f*** night long.
I was at my grandma's. I told Silvio I was coming.
You answer me like I'm Jesus Christ himself, and if you f***ing lie to me, may your mother die. I can't tell the eyes.
Oh, my God. It gives me chills. The Sopranos marks its 20th anniversary this week. Joining us on the line to talk about how it changed television is Bob Thompson. Bob's a professor and founding director of the Bleier Center for TV and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse. Hey there, Bob.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Excellent.
Oh, great. Boy, was it great to hear that scene from The Sopranos. So how did The Sopranos change TV, Bob Thompson?
Well, I think the big shows that made the big changes that moved television into this artistic, literary, sophisticated place that it is now was first way back in 1981 with the appearance of Hill Street Blues. And then, of course, in January, 1999, when The Sopranos debuted. So it is marked as the beginning of that big, what would become the explosion of cable quality, and then that would go on to streaming high-quality shows as well. But we should be a little careful not to completely overstate the importance of this show, as though we'd still be watching Mr. Ed if The Sopranos hadn't come along. Because already HBO had done a show called Oz, the prison
drama. Oh, that's right.
And that debuted July 12th of 1997. And all the things that people talk about that The Sopranos innovated and pushed the medium along, Oz had pretty much done a lot of that stuff as well. The big difference, of course, was that The Sopranos was spectacularly successful. Oz didn't have nearly the number of viewers. And that's what pushes certain types of programming to be imitated and to have more like The Maid is if they're really successful. So I don't mean to downplay the quality of The Sopranos, one of the greatest TV shows ever made, or its impact. Its impact was very significant. But it wasn't operating in a vacuum.
Okay, let me continue to overstate its importance, if I may. Just to get a taste, here's a little more from it. While performing an errand for Tony at a bakery, Christopher takes his frustration out on the clerk in this scene by shooting him in the foot for making him wait. Here it is.
Hey, Gino. Can I get you?
He's some,
Whoa, number 34, right here. He was in line, man. He just went out to go get gas in his car.
Oh, so I could go out, f*** your sister, come back Saturday, I go to the front of the line?
I said he could.
Hey, poppin' fresh, I'm in no f***ing mood today. I'm next. Now get a f***ing pastry box.
Gino, what can I get you?
Oh!
It's all right, Doug. You let him go first.
He don't make the rules here.
All right, let me have two Neapolitan loaves.
You touch a single f***ing crust, you're going to wish you took that job at McDonald's.
F*** you.
Okay, take a walk.
All right, poppin' fresh. I'll tell you, tonight on television, by the way, I don't know if you know this, Marjorie, I have three locals. The guy who played Gigi, who everybody remembers
infamously. Yeah, I've heard you talking about this for a
week,
Jim.
Died on the toilet. Marianne Leone, who played Christopher's mother, and Frank Santarelli. We've had him on, a local comic,
yep,
who played Georgie, the bartender at the Bada Bing. So I am like, oh, so Sopranoed up.
That's
just, you know, Bob, I don't know if we ever, what'd you think of the ending?
I thought it was a perfect ending.
Yeah.
I mean, it was incredibly frustrating. It's not the ending. Well, we've talked before about how Sex and the City was an ending that made everybody happy, but it betrayed what the show was all about. Mm-hmm. The Sopranos was an ending that made everybody upset, but was the perfect ending. I mean, from the very first episode of The Sopranos, it was about, and Tony pretty much comes right out and says this. He comes too late to this business. He doesn't get enough respect. He wanted to be Don Corleone, and in fact, he's Al Bundy or Homer Simpson. And in the end, he doesn't get what he always wanted. He doesn't get to go out in a blaze of glory. He goes out listening to some Journey and eating onion rings. And I think
That's absolutely
the perfect ending for that show.
Yeah, as I think I told you, I didn't when I first saw it, but I have probably watched, and I'm not exaggerating, maybe 100 times in the intervening years, and I agree with you, it is absolutely perfect.
Well, because it grew on you. I mean, and you thought, okay, does he continue on? Or do they all get shot that night? I mean, what does happen that you just don't know? And I like that ambivalence. It would seem perfect to me after you thought about it for a few days, right? Yeah.
Right. And of course, in the end, this is all about art. The answer to your question is nothing happens. That's mm-hmm. the end of the show. These people don't exist, and they cease to exist when the program stops. So unless they do a movie, which everybody keeps talking about, that question will remain ambivalent.
So what's the best of the week there, Bob Thompson?
I'm giving it to our colleagues at PBS, or your colleagues
at
PBS. In what, 3 days last week, just one great interview after another. On Monday, part of the Independent Lens series, My Country No More, mm-hmm. about oil drilling in North Dakota and how it affected this little town of farm town of Trenton between 2011 and 2016. Tuesday, a great documentary on the USS Indianapolis, which was torpedoed after delivering nuclear weapon stuff, and many of the people were attacked by sharks. It was one of, I think, the biggest casualties of any naval sinking.
Hold on. I love that line from one of the survivors who said, remember, well, that was a great scene in Jaws when Captain Quint, Robert Shaw, talks mm-hmm. about how he was out in Indianapolis and they were all in the water and the sharks were circling. And one of the real survivors yeah. says in that documentary that after 2 days in the water, you just didn't care anymore about the screams of the other yeah. men because you've been in the water for so long. I just had to squeeze that in there. I'm sorry, Bob. Go ahead.
Yeah, so Monday we get rural North Dakota oil drilling. Tuesday we get the USS Indianapolis. And Wednesday, it hasn't ended yet. David Attenborough, who I like just about anything that he does, gives us Attenborough and the Sea Dragon, which had a line in it that I've repeated 100 times over and over. Attenborough says, "It's extremely rare to find a new species of ichthyosaur these days." he's totally right about that.
We've got a little clip from this. From the Attenborough and the Sea Dragon. Here's Attenborough.
Dorset was the very first place where they found a really complete skeleton of one of these creatures. Well, people thought it was some kind of monster. But what was it? They thought it was a kind of cross between a reptile and a fish. So they called it an ichthyosaur, a fish lizard, or sea dragon.
God.
Did I ever tell either of you that a couple of years ago we were in London visiting my younger daughter who was in school for a semester? My older daughter, who was then in her mid-20s, stood in line for 4 or 5 hours when Attenborough had a new book out. And as she's approaching the moment when he's going to sign her book like he does, she starts weeping. She is so excited to shake his hand.
Oh, that's great.
It was
great.
One of the most moving, sweetest
was that
things ever.
Of Jurassic Park?
No, because she's just a huge admirer of all of his. What is he, 90 something years old now?
I think he's in his 90s, and he's been doing 60 years he's been doing this.
Yeah, it's pretty great
stuff, or close to it, if not 60. But Wednesday wasn't over, so we get Attenborough and the Sea Dragon, and right after that, PBS starts its 6-part. Dictator's Playbook, and the first episode was on Kim Il-sung, and they're going to do one on Mussolini, Franco, Saddam Hussein, Noriega, and I forget the Idi Amin, I think, are the other five.
That's great.
So
that's
this
quite
is
a lineup.
3 days. Anybody who's saying that PBS is, you know, in the age of HBO and all the rest of it is no longer relevant, they are playing a lot of really, really fine material.
We're talking to Bob Thompson. So what was the worst, even though I think we could probably guess as to what it might be?
Yeah, I'm sick and tired of talking about this, and I'm sure you guys are too. But I have to say the rhetorical disaster that was the Democratic response to the Oval Office thing was I can't believe that was happening in 2018. If that would have been a couple of Cotton and Increase Mather back in 1640, maybe. But, oh, man.
You know, on the day after, we have talked about it a lot, but I haven't read much about it since except mockery. Has anybody done a behind-the-scenes thing as to which of their advisors thought that the two of them standing next to each other staring into the camera like they did was a good communications idea or no?
Well, I haven't seen anything, and I've looked, too, because the question is maybe that before, and they have gotten mockery up one side and down the other, but before, you know, I joined in on that mockery, I was thinking, well, maybe this is all the opportunity they were given. Here's a podium. Here's the camera. Here's where you're going to do your response. That may be the case, and I suppose then we have to look at this a little bit differently. But even there, the way those two stood there, and we know Nancy Pelosi can, you know, she can be active. She can be, you know, she can move. She can be rhetorically effective, as can Schumer. And it was almost as though the two, you know, when you see those hostage videos.
Exactly.
That's what it looked like.
So, Bob, I think we discussed last week the Kevin Hart conundrum and the whole Ellen DeGeneres thing. And I assumed that that was a prelude to the Oscars and Hart having a rapprochement. But apparently the show is going ahead. Not that I really care, but it is a news story. Is going ahead with no host or no lead host, or what are they doing exactly?
Yeah, well, Variety reported that they're going to go ahead now with no host, with a list of A-listers, which, by the way, wouldn't be the first time. We've had many times, not too many times with no host. The last time was 89, and then I think before that in 39 when it wasn't even on TV. But multiple hosts have been done a lot. In the early days, there were 4, 5, 6 hosts, so that's presumably what it's going to be. But now we're hearing that it may be casts from The Avengers, and conveniently enough, where do the Oscars air? ABC. Who owns ABC? Disney. Who owns Marvel? That owns The Avengers? Disney as well. So it could be one great big commercial for... When does that movie come out? In April, I think. So that looks like where we may be going, multiple hosts with people who played superheroes. But who knows? But we're not going to have to wait too long. February 24th is the Oscars.
So does the host – I know we talk about how they have declining ratings year after year after year. Does who the host is have an impact on how many people watch the show, or is it a function of how big a deal it was in the movies that year?
Well, ABC or whatever network is airing it certainly thinks that having a good name recognizable host is a promotion value. I mean, they get stories about who's going to host it and all of that. I've said many times that I think it has very little to do after the first 10 minutes with how the broadcast goes. The hosts have sometimes limited roles after the first thing they do, whether it's song and dance or whether it's a more frequently these days a stand-up routine. But I frankly think that Oscars ratings going down have less to do with who was hosted it on at any given year and more to do with a lot of other variables, some of which are self-inflicted and some of which are institutional.
You know what they should do? They should have Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez host if they weren't ratings.
I was going to ask you.
Schumer and Pelosi?
I was going to ask you about that. Do you have any idea what the demographics are? Because I don't know. None of my kids or their friends.
Right?
Watch the Oscars. I mean, it seems like it's an over 40 or over 50 kind of thing.
Yeah, well, all of broadcast television skews very, very old,
yeah.
Older than I think most people even realize. I think a lot of the networks, if you average everything together, is well into the 50s at average demographic. However, what happened on the Oscars the night before or even that night ends up showing up in streaming venues,
right,
and all the rest of it. So it gets seen. Certainly a lot of young people saw when they gave the Oscar to the wrong movie,
yeah,
a couple of years ago. So that all depends. The audience accrues over time for a couple of days.
I think the average age actually for shows like 60 Minutes is disinterred. That's the average... Give or take a couple of years. We're talking to Bob Thompson.
So Bob Thompson, Megyn Kelly, whose stint on the Today Show did not go well, but she's leaving with all her $69 million intact from her contract. So, I mean, if you had $69,000, maybe you just like
million
sail into the sunset, or do you try to go back and do something else? I don't know. I mean, she could have a very nice life. Her husband's a novelist, raised the kids.
So could Tom Brady. I mean, people want to stay in the spotlight, don't they?
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean,
not everybody.
I think whatever brought Megyn Kelly or anybody else to those jobs is not comfort. And for that matter, I don't think ultimately in the beginning money. This was a woman who in 2015 said, you know, Barbara Walters did her thing. Oprah Winfrey has now gone over to OWN. Why not me? She saw herself in the progression of Barbara Walters to Oprah Winfrey to Megyn Kelly. And she was only, halfway through her $69 million contract, which means they gave her about $30 million that was left on that. She has a non-disparagement clause, so we're probably not going to get a lot of the details. But as of Friday, she didn't even have an agent, much less a job lined up. So I'm not sure exactly where she will end up. I don't think it'll be a major broadcast network, and I don't think it'll be one of the big three cable channels. Whether it will be one of these sub situations, I don't think she's going to be unhireable, but I don't think she's going to be on any of the big shows.
Well, there's a big problem with Megyn Kelly. I mean, the fact that she thought she could somehow segue into being anything close to Oprah Winfrey, who's Ms. Compassion and Empathy, and, you know, it just is a terrible misreading of her own, what made her a star. You know what I mean?
I think that you're absolutely right. That what she did at Fox very well. It required a completely different skill set than Oprah Winfrey, or for that matter, even Barbara Walters had. And I think she should have known that. The people at NBC should have known that. And by the way, we did talk about this when that was first announced that she was going to NBC, that we didn't know exactly how this was going to end with regards to the Halloween costumes. But I think all three of us agreed that this probably wasn't a very good match.
So you don't think CNN is a likely? I mean, I've assumed all along that there's a cooling off period and then she gets a job at CNN. No?
I don't think so. If
I
were a CNN executive, my biggest worry would be I would be sending a message that the standards for what you say on the air are this high for NBC, and they're a little lower for us, so we're going to pick her.
Because of the racism stuff in particular.
Yeah, and I mean, let's face it, that was there. I guess there are gradations of offensiveness, but I don't know. If I were running CNN, I certainly wouldn't.
She's not even 50 years old. I just looked it up, by the way.
Well, not everybody has to keep going forever, Jim.
Well, but who's tell me a person who was at the top of their game and had a fall. She didn't commit a crime.
Johnny
it isn't
Carson.
Like she's going to jail. He was 70 years old or something when he quit.
I don't think he was 70 years old.
I think he was.
Yeah.
In any case.
How old was he?
But
do
you're
we know,
right. When
we
he
know
retired,
Bob?
Boy, did he ever retire.
Yeah, I think not everybody has that. They got to go keep going forever. Anyway, we talked last week about this surviving R. Kelly on television, which detailed the gross sexual abuse and his supposed dungeon of these young girls, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, he's in trouble with the law, with a prosecutor out in Chicago.
Right. A police have opened an investigation in Georgia. That happened like 48 hours after the last episode of the documentary aired. Cook County judge has granted an emergency motion for the Chicago building inspectors to inspect his studio, which, of course, featured a lot in the documentary. I guess the good news about this is that decades-old story is finally getting some action. The scary news is that it took a lifetime documentary to make it happen. I mean, how did Cosby finally have the dominoes begin to fall? It was a stand-up comedian, Hannibal Buress, who got that going. And now Lifetime, you know, the network we make fun of for They Stole My Child, made-for-TV movies, and Christmas in the Hamptons movies and all that kind of stuff. And Lifetime does a documentary, and it was a very compelling and very disturbing and I think a very good documentary. And then finally, things that people have been saying about R. Kelly for literally decades is starting to get some legal movement. That's a little disturbing.
You know, but I haven't seen it yet. I was hoping to watch it this weekend. I just never got around to it, but I will. But while there's been a lot of talk about all the celebrities who knew and did nothing and are now trying to do a CYA kind of thing, does it address the issue about why the criminal justice system overlooked what I mean, even I knew about these things, and I'm not exactly an R. Kelly fan. Is it talk about that at all, or no?
Yeah. I mean, what, Family Guy, South Park, jokes have been being made about this for a long, long time. What I think is what happens in these documentaries is you get all of this testimony, and the camera is ruthless. You are right on the victims. And that is that gets people to pay attention in a way that nothing else seems to do. What was it? The New York Magazine cover with all of Cosby's accusers on it. But it is disturbing that it seems like the criminal justice system can't operate without the lubrication of what a television show is able to bring by bringing us these accusers. And that's, again, that's an issue. I don't think we should need Lifetime to make this stuff
exactly.
happen.
Exactly. We're talking to Bob Thompson. So, Bob, what are we watching in this week ahead?
Well, this is not a recommendation, but it's what I'm going to be watching. HBO debuts on Saturday its movie Brexit, the Uncivil War. Benedict Cumberbatch
stars, yeah.
Right, as the Leave campaign director. And already this has gotten a lot of complaints and controversy that the timing isn't right. We're still in the middle of this story. Is it going to glorify some things it shouldn't be glorifying? So it's already a lot of people talking about it. That's HBO Saturday.
Here's a little piece of the trailer from Brexit and the Uncivil War. Here it is.
This is an insurgence against the establishment.
We're going to build something
that will restack the odds in our favor.
What are your expectations, realistically?
To create the biggest political upset since the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Now the fight for Britain begins.
You are feeding a toxic culture
of fear and hate.
You can't close the box once it's been opened. What's your edge?
What have you found?
There is a new politics in town. One that you cannot control.
You know, it sounds great, and you know I'm a huge Benedict Cumberbatch fan, but here's my mathematic equation. Is everything he does is one less thing, one less Sherlock that's on the air. And I'll tell you, I live for those Sherlock things.
But, you know, so. I didn't, you know, what you were just saying about R. Kelly is different, obviously, because it could result in criminal charges. But I think this could be an eye-opener for lots of people. I didn't know a lot of this stuff. I didn't know there was a possible criminal investigation pending about cheating on the regulations.
Oh, they exceeded the limits.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people didn't know these details, and it could be fascinating. And then you have the weigh-in of Steve Bannon, used to be the president's right-hand man. He's a big supporter of Brexit, you know, the big populist movement, complaining it's a clown show and so forth. I think this could be, if people watch it, kind of a big eye-opener.
Well, you are right that I think very few Americans know much about Brexit. And when it comes to the details, I would have to put myself in that category as well. I think some of the complaints that are being lodged against this, some of them based exclusively on that trailer that we just heard, is the way to educate a population about an important issue that is going down as we speak, a fictional interpretation of it starring Benedict Cumberbatch. And that, I think, is also a good question.
Well, what's interesting about this, too, which we'll see what happens when it comes out, but the guy that wrote it has apparently has a history of this, did a thing about the House, about Parliament. And
Graham, is that his
name? Yeah, James Graham. Mm-hmm. He wrote the script for this, did a thing about the Coalition, about political horse trading. It's done all these fictional things about British politics, which is including the rise of Rupert Murdoch and the tabloid Sun. And Rupert Murdoch, of course, who owns the Wall Street Journal and Fox. And he doesn't own Fox News anymore. Does he still own Fox News?
I don't know.
He tried to get he did own Fox News. He tried to get that big British broadcasting company, but he couldn't. But he owns all these tabloids in Great Britain, so he's got a pretty impressive history of writing about British politics.
Yeah, I think it's going to be an interesting film, but I think it's going to continue to be controversial. That's why it's my what to watch.
We'll be watching. Thanks so much, Bob. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you very much,
wait.
Bob
Thank
Thompson.
You.
Bob Thompson joins us every week. He's the founding director of the Blyer Center for TV and Popular Culture and a trustee professor of TV and Popular Culture at Newhouse School.
You hear what's playing in the background?
Oh, God, the opening of The Sopranos. Didn't this get you revved up every time you heard it? Rupert Murdoch does still own Fox News, by the way. Anyway, great to talk to Bob Thompson, as always. Coming up, Guster is here, performing live from the WGBH Fraser Performance Studio with their new album, Guster, live next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie. And we are broadcasting from our GBH Fraser Performance Studio with a special guest. That would be Guster, the alternative rock band that got its start in Boston. We are joined by lead singer and guitarist Ryan Miller. Ryan, it's great to see you again.
Hello.
Hi, Ryan.
Nice to see you guys.
That was the oddest. Can we hear him again one more time? Hello, Ryan. It's nice to see you.
Hello.
Whatever.
I'm trying to do my NPR voice.
Whatever. You're here. That's all that matters.
He's
vocalist and guitarist Adam Gardner. Let's see if you can do better.
Can you hear me?
Not really. But no, nice
really.
To see you,
hi,
too.
Nice to see you, too.
Drummer and percussionist Brian Rosenworcel. Hi, Brian.
Here I am on this microphone.
I think that's a little better. And multi-instrumentalist. I love that, by the way. The relative new kid on the block, Luke Reynolds. It's great to see you, Luke.
Hey, good to see you, too. Hi.
And their new album, by the way, which comes out this Friday, which is really exciting, and they're going to play from it in a couple of minutes, is called Look Alive. And we have a present for you. I don't know where our coworker is.
We do.
We apparently do not have a present for you because
we
have no coworker.
Yes, Jim went and bought you a present this
morning.
It's
a
dozen.
This is not very professional right off the bat.
Right off the bat.
It's a bad start. But can I tell you what the present was?
Please.
The present in honor of your, from what I understand, legendary performance many years ago at Twin Donuts down the street in Alston, was a dozen donuts, paid for by me, by the way, not to be reimbursed, a dozen donuts from Twin Donut, and I don't know where they are, but they're coming soon.
But thank you for the gift, quote unquote.
Sort of, yes.
I got you a lot of stuff, too.
But I got you a car. There seems to be some confusion about what exactly went on in the parking lot at Twin Donuts. Are
it
we
was
making
the best
too much?
We ever played.
Best gig you ever played in the parking lot at Twin Donuts. Okay. All right.
How'd that come about, by the way? I mean,
I'm trying to think of the least cool place to play in a dumpster behind a Twin Donuts on Comm Ave.
How are you enjoying the donuts, by the way?
How are we enjoying them?
Yeah.
Oh, they're delicious. It's the best fake donuts I've ever had.
Oh, there they are. Can you do me a favor?
Look at that. I take it all back.
You can eat while they're upside down, the box, which is not. Take them with you wherever you go.
They are supposed to be very good donuts. Supposed to be very good donuts.
Now, can you, for those who don't know you as well as we do, both personally, sort of, and professionally, three of the four of you met on day one at Tufts, is that true?
Pre-day one, like day negative, because we were in an orientation situation. So school hadn't even really started, and that's when it all. That's how we met. And now look, it's 26 years later.
27, actually, I think.
Really?
Whatever. What drew the three of you? What was the Brian, Adam, Ryan connection? What drew you to each other?
I had a ponytail.
Don't you wish you had one now, by
the
way?
Actually, no, I don't. I mean, I wish I had enough hair to put in a ponytail. I think ultimately what it kind of came down to is we were all in bands in high school. So it was, the idea was we wanted to be able to go and play music that wasn't like, I don't think any of us wanted to be in a cover, continue to be in a cover band. And we didn't know any of the same music anyway. So we started writing music right out of the gates.
Adam, what did you think of Ryan the first time you saw him?
I asked him if he sang, and he said no.
Sorry, bro.
It's like, I really like harmonies. And he's like, no, I don't sing.
And Brian, what was your impression of these two guys, your first encounter?
I really wanted them to let me into their band, so I pretended I was good at the bongos, but really, I just had a pair on my shelf, and I didn't even know how to play them.
Yeah, bongos. I mean, so you kind of segued into a more impressive percussionist from the bongos.
I'm really surprised they let me in. but yeah, as the years tore on, I kind of grew the kit into a more elaborate percussion thing.
Okay. And Luke Reynolds, do you feel sort of left out here?
No, not at all. I'm checking out which donut I'm going to take.
Okay, all right. they're very, very good.
Where'd you go to college, Luke? I don't think we know that.
I did the first half of school at Lamont School of Music. in Denver, and then the second half at Belmont School of Music in Nashville.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
He's the actual only real musician in this band.
Can you guys, by the way, I've heard a lot of this. Marjorie and I listened to a lot of your new album last night, and it's spectacular.
It's great.
Can you play now, and then we'll talk a little bit more?
Yeah, let's play.
What are you playing first?
We're going to play a song called Hard Times.
Great.
And this is kind of our NPR edition.
Oh, excellent.
Like a gentle warming.
Here's Guster.
Enter a scene that defies description. They say to open your mind and take it all inside, one click at a time. We move through fictions and send our sisters to the sacrifice. Sinister systems keep us satisfied. These are hard times.
I'm breathing in the oxygen. I'm holding it through hard times. I'm breathing out in the ultrasound. Things come around. Hard times.
10,000 miles of the new prescriptions. So we open our mouths and take them all inside, one pill at a time. The purest fiction. And send our sisters to the sacrifice. Sinister systems keep us satisfied. These are hard times.
I'm breathing in the oxygen. I'm holding in through hard times. I'm breathing out in the ultrasound. Things come around. Oxygen, I'm holding in.
These are hard times.
I'm breathing out in the ultrasound. Things come around.
These are hard times.
I'm breathing in the oxygen.
Take it all inside.
I'm holding in.
Take it all inside.
Hard times.
Hard Times from Look Alive, from Guster.
Okay. I want to know, what was that about?
What's that?
Yeah, tell me what that was about.
The song?
Yeah.
That performance of the song, or just the like, what's the lyric about?
Yeah.
We were just talking before, and we're literally like, this is the second interview we've really done about the record, so I'm not into my canned anecdotes part yet, so I have to really think about the question. I mean, this song was like very unusual in the sense that a lot of lyrics are always the hardest thing for us / me, and some of these songs we've been working on for years, and lyrics take sometimes months and months to work on, and we wrote this song in the studio. So usually I'll write a lyric as a sort of rough draft, and then I'll kind of mess it up. And this is NPR, obfuscate? Is that a word?
Obfuscate, yes.
Yes, that's right.
Thank you.
Like a politician.
Yeah, so that's what I usually do. It's like I'll say something maybe plain spoken, and then I'll try and make it more metaphorical. So it's less, for whatever reason, I feel like it kind of gives you somewhere to dig. And there really wasn't time for that in the studio. and also, you know, a lot of this record was written over the last couple years, and you know, I'm a thinking, feeling individual who reads the news and feels some of this stuff very deeply. So a lot of the themes on the record are sort of concerned with, you know, me and my children and our place in the world and what's kind of happening. I mean, the song is called Hard Times. We're talking about, you know, how clicking through things is fictional, and we talk about sending our sisters to the sacrifice. I mean, a lot of this stuff, I'm kind of wearing it on my sleeve. The song's called Hard Times. I mean, it's like I'm really just kind of laying it out there, and it's a little scary for me to do that. But I think that's where we also is really fun to be, is in a really scary place.
You know, Ryan, you said you wrote this over a couple of years. Didn't I read somewhere that you wrote this thing in a car wash or something, or over a car wash, or
no, there was
over a car dealership or some such thing?
Yeah, in Maine.
Oh, you did? Thank you, Brian, for bailing me out.
I like your research
I didn't,
team.
Yeah, we did.
We have a very good research team.
Well, go ahead.
We all live in different places, so we write songs. We kind of get together.
At a car wash.
There. And in Portland, Maine, Adam hooked us up with this rehearsal space on top of a car dealership. So we actually got 3 songs out of that spot.
Oh, that's pretty good. Are you aware of the fact that somebody just snuck into your band? Do you know that? Or does that concern you or not? There's a guy over here.
Oh,
just
over there?
Snuck in.
I don't know that guy.
Yeah, with the saxophone.
No, we know that guy. No, we're aware. We're bringing it all today. We're bringing our full production to our unplugged performance here today.
You know what I wondered, any of you guys can answer this, but we talked the last time about how your wives conceived of babies within 4 months of each other, all girls, I believe.
Yes.
And you told me before we started that they're 11 now.
They're going on 11.
So now that they're 11, like really into music and, you know, all that, you know, all that stuff and the phones and the whole deal, what do they think of Guster? Are you guys cool? Are you guys embarrassed?
Sure, we all have different answers for that. I mean, I live in Burlington, Vermont.
Yeah.
So it's a very different situation than Brian, who he lives in Brooklyn and his kids go to school with like all celebrities. So his kids probably think about him differently than we do. I always just say, you know, a few people will recognize me when we're out and they've been on tour with us, obviously. And I think it's like, oh, my dad's just a little bit famous. That's just kind of how it is. That's just how we kind of digest it in our family.
So about you, Adam, is your kids think you're neat or embarrassing?
I think in another year it'll be embarrassing, but right now it's okay. And we're keenly aware of that, okay, too. Like, how long are we going on tour for? This is it. This is the window where they like us.
Brian, I won't ask you about Brooklyn because I suspect they grow up a little faster in Brooklyn, huh?
There's so many celebrities.
Okay. How is, you know, one of you guys is quoted saying we never do the same thing again, describing this eighth studio album of yours. How is this different from what you've done before? Any of you, Ryan, Adam, Brian, Luke, anybody? How is it different?
Well, you can go. I mean, I think a lot of it is that we try and become better songwriters and lyricists and performers every time out. But a lot of the sonics are really the things that I think changes from record to record. Our last record was made with our friend Richard Swift, who has a very specific way of approaching making music. It's a lot of first takes. It was really not a fidelity issue. It was all vibe. And we recorded 14 songs in 3 weeks. And that was like that. And it really what it comes down to. And then this guy, Leo Abrahams, who we collaborated with, couldn't be more the opposite. He's incredibly fastidious, super molecular, down to the detail, would work on something for days and days. And so I think what a lot of it comes down to is our intention going into it, but also the collaborators that we choose. I mean, we've self-produced a record or two, but I think a lot of times our producers really, when it's done right, the producers kind of get to shine through in a lot of ways. So
this thing is formally released on Friday. Obviously, you're pretty happy with it. You hadn't released it. Are you nervous about how anything new you do is received by your fans and the public, Adam?
We try not to be. I,
but are you? I mean,
I don't. Not particularly. I think at this stage, at least the folks that come to our concerts, they expect something new every time we come out. I think they'd be disappointed if we kind of did the same records over and over.
But do you when you know that the reviews are going to come out, do you like wait up for whatever paper? You really don't?
I totally. I mean, I do. I read everything.
That's Ryan telling the truth there.
Written about our band.
And how do you take it?
But what's cool about this, and I think you guys know this, because while we're probably not the same age, we're also at an age where you sort of care less and less about how things are consumed and more about what you've made. And like the older I get, the more I believe in what I do, and sort of shutting out the noise. And, you know, we have amazing collaborators in each other. So we have the checks and balances. It's not like anything's gotten past any of us. And we all know a lot of stuff. So like, I don't think that all of this is going to go over super well, like right out of the gate, and some might not ultimately. I mean, that song is very serious and called Hard Times, and in this next song, I sing in an English accent. You know what I mean? And it's kind of, and it's a really strange record. I think it's the most disparate and sort of, you know, it's a hard thing to kind of pull together. But we really like, we know this stuff so, we've spent so much time on this record. I can stand behind every note of it.
So if you sing in a British accent, how'd you vote on Brexit?
Oh, I obviously love Brexit.
Okay, fine.
Yeah, I was going to say before you switch into Brexit that that's a very mature attitude that other people might embrace in their.
She's talking about me, actually.
Yeah, that's right.
I am very. She's talking about me.
So, can we hear this song?
What are you playing?
It's called Overexcited.
Overexcited.
This is Guster.
I'm halfway home at the pub on the corner of the street. I see kids from school and I stare down at my feet, sports on TV. They scream for victory. A few blocks down, there's Dawn, she's got spinach on her teeth. In between the front ones, just a little bitty leaf, and I try to speak. But Dawn makes me nervous. And I get overexcited. Can't do a damn thing about it. My God, we're shoulder to shoulder. Nice guy looking for a future lover. The pet shop's closed. Too bad. 'Cause animals like me back. We had a dog once, we all just called a cat, was Mum's idea. She's got a great sense of humour. Later tonight, some soup, then I'll probably send a text. Hey Don, it's Jim, would you like to have the sex? And if that's too weird, maybe just a hot chocolate.
Excited from Look Alive from Guster. Do you want to say that's Kelly Pratt, or should I say it's Kelly Pratt? That is Kelly Pratt.
That's saxophone.
He was unbelievable.
Yeah, Kelly.
Nicely done. What's with the British accent?
Sorry, I couldn't hear.
What's with the British accent?
You know, I couldn't really tell you, although I did an interview on the way down, and someone said, you know, historically, how much of yourself is in your lyrics? And I think that I was like, oh, everything I talk about is basically me, some version of me. And then I was like, oh, except for Overexcited, I wasn't me, so I was playing a character. So I think to even, like, distance myself further, I was like just... And I don't know. And plus, we really like that song. We really like Madness, and we were really trying to be like Madness. So, and our producer was British, and he gave us permission to do it because all it takes is one British guy to tell you it's okay, and he did, so we did. And it just sort of fit because if I was just going, the pet shop's closed, too bad. I don't know. I just didn't feel like it has. It wouldn't feel comfortable for me.
No,
I
think sense. Right. I no, think it does.
I don't know. I don't really know. It's a great question. I don't know how to answer.
I think spinach in your teeth is something that we can all relate to. Really, right? In the song. Why is it always a spinach? By the way, you
it's always
about
spinach.
That? It is spinach. Why isn't it romaine lettuce?
I don't know because they don't eat lettuce.
Yeah,
in Britain.
I guess so. It's very dangerous. To
maybe they do.
To eat a spinach kind of salad. Hey, you guys have got a contest going, which I thought was sort of neat. This is radio, so people can't see that your album cover has a picture of a woman with sort of an embroidered hat on her head. So, tell us about the contest.
Well, basically, I kind of ADD, and I'm constantly like fiddling with my phone. So before we went into the studio, I didn't want to always be on my phone. So I really like embroidery. So I started embroidering. Like when we were sitting in the studio, I learned like 4 stitches. So I could just like that's on my shirt. I have stuff everywhere. I'm like everything just to get my hands busy. So then I was on Instagram like looking how to do embroidery, and I found this artist, this woman Nikki Verbitsky, who did that, and I was like, this is beautiful art. And when it all kind of felt like, and then when we called the album Look Alive and we saw that image, it all kind of tied together, and she did our faces and stuff. It was just one of those sort of kismet moments.
How often do you guys, I mean, everybody lives in a different place, yes?
Different state, yeah.
How often do you see each other and rehearse and all that kind of stuff?
I mean, we're together. This is our job. This is kind of our main job. Yeah. So, like, we're touring. We're usually either touring or writing or recording. You know, I mean, we see each other at least every month. And sometimes, you know, like, we're leaving now. And we're going, my son was crying last night when I left. And it's like, why are you leaving for months? It's like, it's just 1 month, Ash. You know what
Your
I mean?
Kids so, still
like,
cry?
But the contest, though, this is kind of a neat thing. If you order, I'm reading from this press release right here, if you pre-order Look Alive through the Guster website, you can get, and the reason I mentioned that artist, that this Nikki Verbitsky, the Look Alive album artist, will immortalize one's fan portrait in full embroidery style.
That's
right?
Such a good idea. Yeah. Who's doing that?
Yeah.
We're
yeah.
doing that?
Yeah, you're doing
That's
that.
Awesome. Way to
you're
go,
doing
management.
That. And also, one acoustic house show during the upcoming 2019 tour, live streamed on Guster's social media.
Oh, I thought
from
we vetoed that. Way
you
to
did?
Go, Guster Management.
From living room, from somebody's living room.
Oh, I really thought we said we weren't going to do that.
Really? Well, you better yep. take it off your
well,
press
release. Well, I guess release. We are. We really love doing those kind
yeah,
of things.
Yeah, go to somebody's living room and do it, right?
Yeah,
this is sort of a big living room. I guess the acoustics are better.
So can you go back to the dorm room or whatever? I'm sorry I'm obsessed with the Tufts thing from 27 years ago.
Yeah.
How would they feel about you? How would the Adams and Ryans and Bryans of 1991 feel about the three of you plus Luke and an occasional Kelly in 2018?
You mean
2019,
how do college
whatever
kids interface with Guster or Tufts
Well, how did
kids?
Those college kids, how would those three college
oh,
kids
us?
Feel about
like,
you as you today?
I
yeah.
mean, we listened to terrible music when we met each other, so I don't know. I guess it depends how my self-worth is feeling today.
We'd be pretty confused by yeah. what we're doing right now.
But was this intent? I'm sorry, Brian, why?
I just don't think there's any part of me that's like, I should have been a dentist.
And
dentists are awesome, and dentistry
I'm sure they're
is
great.
Important. But I feel like a kind of unexpected like rock and roll career is something I'll be grateful for.
Well, also, a lot of your fans have basically grown up with you guys. I mean, they followed yeah. you at Tufts, and they followed you right on through.
We made, like, grown-ass women who are like, oh, I was listening to you when I was 9. You know what I mean? And because it's, you know, it's 27 years, and some people have been listening to us, like, for, you know, for more than half their lives.
But isn't that great?
The bulk
isn't
of their
doesn't
life.
That feel
it's,
great?
Listen, I did a lot of this, and I'm not trying to shut you down, but I did a lot of this navel-gazing thing when the 25 came around.
Uh-huh.
And ultimately, what I came out was just so incredibly humbled by the thing, but also like we work really hard to be better at what we do every time, and we work really hard to keep it interesting for ourselves and our fans, and I think there's and we keep each other in check on a lot of levels, and so there's I'm humbled, but I'm also proud. I don't think it's like, and we're not famous, you know, like my kid says, like, you're a little bit famous, but I get to be a full-time musician. I get to come run through this like whole press gauntlet for a week and talk to really smart and interesting people who have smart and interesting things to say about our band. So we're humbled, but we also feel like we're kind of, it's a cool, we're like in a cool, weird band. And I can't wait. This kind of goes back. Like, I can't wait for people to hear the record. It's so unusual for us, and I'm so proud of it. I'm so proud to play it for my friends. And it's just, well, totally out of a left field.
We are really glad that nobody chose to become a dentist, because now they can hear your latest album, Look Alive, which comes out this Friday. You want to learn more about it, go to Guster.com. We've been joined by lead singer and guitarist Ryan Miller, vocalist and guitarist Adam Gardner, drummer and percussionist Brian Rosenworcel, I hope I got that right.
You did, I think.
And the multi-instrumentalist Luke Reynolds, as well as Kelly Pratt on the saxophone and the trumpet. We want to thank all our engineers here at WGBH, went above and beyond for Guster's performance. Miles Smith, John the Claw Parker, Antonio Oliart, Margaret Heffernan, Glenn Heath, and our crew. You guys going to play us out, I think?
By the way, the donuts are great.
Donuts are great.
I don't mean to belabor it, because it's only
great.
$9.
That's
but
right.
It was... They are on us, and they're really great. So what are you playing us out with? Ryan, are you going to tell us?
Well,
by the way, we can't tell you how much we appreciate you coming here. We love you.
Yeah, we love it.
You guys are great.
This
the audience
so
loves
pro.
You.
I'm
it's
playing
really
like
great.
A piano that's more expensive than my house, so that's cool.
When Marjorie and I got a tour of this building, where they were attempting to convince us to come here, and we were ready to come
attempting
regardless,
to convince.
They brought us to this performance center first. And you know what they told us? Don't touch the piano. Honest to God, that's true. But go ahead.
So we kind of came in, we were going to play two new songs, but also same as our live set, we don't want to just like throw our new music down people's throats. So, this is an older song and we didn't really know what we were going to play until about 45 minutes ago. And I don't think we don't ever play this song live. I think this one is us really reacting to playing a very expensive piano.
This is a song,
off our last record called Farewell.
Guster.
I think, yeah. All right. Was everybody, did you have any more questions? Or do you? No, I'm serious. I didn't
know. No, we're thrilled to hear you play.
Okay, yeah. Well, hey, if we don't get a chance, we're not saying goodbyes yet.
We may not.
Okay, if we don't, thank you.
It's
oh,
really
thank
cool
you.
To be welcome.
Able to come in, like I said, and like have a nice conversation with people that care and listen to our band and don't just want to talk about when we were at Tufts. Oh.
Oops. Sorry about that.
I'm just kidding. This is awesome. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. Guster, ready?
Guster.
Did you guys figure out why that? No? Okay, great.
Who you talking to? I wish that will never come true. You tried to cheat gravity, but what can you do? Something untrue. You tried to cheat gravity. What can you do? Free.